There's 100,000 in the street, and that number's gonna grow.
The Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
It's time for the Rick Smith Show.
I want you to get up now. I want all of you to get up out of your chairs. I want you to get up right now and go to the window, open it, and stick your head out and yell, I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore.
They don't want to abolish government. I simply want to reduce it to the size where I can drag it into the bathroom and drown it in the bathtub.
You bet I cut the taxes at the top.
How dare you? How dare you? Go ahead. Make my day.
The Rick Smith Show starts now. Now.
Welcome, geniuses, philosopher kings and queens, lovers of freedom, fairness, and democracy, truth, justice, the American way. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks for being here tonight on the big program. We're going to talk to our good friend, attorney Irwin Aronson, about some of the things going on here in Harrisburg, some of the anti-worker stuff coming up, and also this unemployment compensation thing that just has me scratching my head why there's no push forward when on May 20th we're going to lose a boatload of federal money to help our citizens, and why the Republicans who are controlling our state government don't seem to be all that interested. I kind of understand why, kind of know why. They don't give a damn about the working people of this state, but you can't just come out and say that. Well, wait a minute. I just did. So there you go. The truth be told, they really don't care about the unemployed. They have no concern for them whatsoever because, after all, the unemployed don't have an awful lot of lobbying money. They don't have a whole bunch of campaign money to be pushing around. So that's why they never get their voices heard. So we'll have a good conversation with our good friend Irwin Aronson. In the second hour, Larry Spivak, he's going to be here talking about the anniversary, the 125th anniversary of the Haymarket Square massacre. You know, one of the things that I've really been amazed at is how very little the average citizen knows about labor's history. And it's because we're not taught. It's not in any of the schools, and I think in this state, and it should be. But, you know, like in places like Wisconsin, you go to the streets there, and people have a sense of labor's history. They have a sense of the hard-fought battles for minimum wage, the hard-fought battles for an eight-hour day, for weekends, for vacation, for all of the things that we take for granted. And you go back 125 years, and you see the battles, this massacre that happened for the eight-hour day, and it took years longer because of this. And I'm saying, and we'll find out from Larry Spivak what his thoughts are, that the person, whoever it was who threw this bomb, was probably a plant, an agent provocateur. And if you look at what happened in Wisconsin when the fake Koch brother called Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker and said, hey, why don't we send in some troublemakers? And Walker said, you know, we thought about that. That should have made the hair stand up on the back of everyone's neck, that a representative of we the people had even thought of it. Had even thought of it. Also in the second hour, Garrett Epps going to be here. He's a constitutional professor, novelist, going to talk about the debt ceiling. And the fact of the matter is, you know, you look at what Republicans are doing, and this is a hostage situation. They know that they've got what we need. They're going to hold this country hostage for the sole purpose of extracting more for their side. The same thing they did in the lame duck session after last November, when They needed to get an extension of unemployment before Christmas, or you're going to have millions of people basically out of luck. And what did the Republicans do? They held those unemployed people who were already suffering. They held them hostage. And they said, no, we're not going to give you the little bit of help you're going to need to survive through the winter. No, no. Not until you give us. You give us what we've always wanted. Big handouts to the very wealthy in the form of a reduced estate tax. You know, they wanted to do away with it. They were happy when it was gone. So when the birth lottery winners, parents died off or grandparents died off, all tax-free. Anyway, our friend Mr. Epps, he believes that the president should stand up and give a speech that what the Republicans are doing is unconstitutional, and I agree. In the third hour, Paul Segunda, he's going to be here talking about the National Labor Relations Board decision on Boeing and all the movement around this. The NLRB's really taken a lot of heat from the Republicans, even though this Boeing has broken the law. This is quid pro quo. This is illegal what they have done. They've come out and said, look, we're moving because they strike. In this country, workers have that right. And to come out and be brazen enough to say this is why we're doing it. Just amazing. We're going to talk about that and so much more. Your calls, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Today, another one of those days where the right is still trying to figure out. They're kind of all over the place. They haven't quite gotten their talking points from the Heritage Foundation yet. There's some common themes popping up, but they're trying to figure out how to attack Obama. Without showing how absolutely ticked off they are that Obama was able to get bin Laden. And what I find amazing is, I guess as a country, we can never come together and celebrate a common interest. I think everybody in the country is happy that this menace is gone, that no longer is he going to be able to terrorize this country. But what I find just amazing is that right from the start, you had the guy, the Joe Scarborough, coming out saying, well, you know, I'm happy that the president did what he did, but, you know, he went against his base. No, he didn't. He followed what his base wanted. And this is the kind of stuff that I think people need to wake up and realize that Republicans are just out there to be divisive right now. Can't we just have this moment as a nation where we go, you know what? We have done the right thing. The president acted decisively. He's been successful. He should be given credit for what he has done, for what the troops have done. The whole, it all worked. And, you know, on the right, the talk machine over there, the echo chamber over there, not going to give up on this. You can hear the pain in their voices. As they, with backhanded compliments, say, well, you know, the president was, you know, he did the right thing. And we should be proud of that. When you can just feel it in their tone that they want to attack him, So, the president is not going to release the photos, and I think it's probably a wise thing to do. Why do we need to have more ammunition out there to recruit people who hate us even more, just so we can have some morbid sense that of I don't know. There's part of me that goes. There's a part inside of me that goes. I want to see the demise. In fact, I want to see the video. I want to see how it all went down. And then there's part of me that says that would be something that would incite people who hate us, and it would be something that would be used constantly as a recruiting tool. So I'm not thrilled with the prospect of him not releasing it, but I think it's the right thing. I think he has, again, made another smart decision, and that, you know, while we may, as a bloodthirsty society, we may want to see the gruesome photos, we may want to see the corpse, I think this is the right move. And what I find interesting, though, And again, you know, you go back to all of the stories that are now going to come out, and there are hundreds of them. That UCLA, one of the, I think it was one of the geography departments, came up with, you know, he was going to be in a big city within 300 miles of where he was last seen. And, you know, a whole bunch of stuff. You know, there's a reporter who's claiming that when she was in the place where they found him, that, you know, she saw him. And they're driving in a cab down the road. The story goes back in 2002, and she's with her friend. And they go, there's Bin Laden. There's Bin Laden. You know, because he was, of course, much taller than everyone else. It couldn't have been just another tall Arab guy. It had to be Bin Laden. And they're screaming in the cab, there's Bin Laden. And it didn't cause a riot, which I thought was kind of interesting as well. The other story I came across that made me laugh is one of the stories came out that said that evidently he was growing pot. So now Bin Laden's a pothead, that he had a whole, you know, whole area in his vegetable garden where he was growing some pot. So now he's a pothead. And again, I think we're going to hear tons of these stories going forward, because everybody's going to want their piece of, I found something special. And I think it's all going to be ridiculous. I think what we have to do now is we have to look at this as one of those moments at the end of the road where we go, we have mission accomplished, because the mission going into Afghanistan was to capture or kill Bin Laden. Remember, smoke him out, dead or alive? Well, we smoked him out. He's now dead. Move on. Move it along. Start bringing our people home. Just leave those folks alone. And as we move down the road, saving us a bunch of money so that we don't have to talk about cutting education. We don't have to talk about cutting Medicare. We don't have to talk about suffering in this country. Because at the end of the day, Afghanistan, you're not going to change. Just not going to happen. So another good day of an entertaining day of listening to the right tell me how Obama did the right thing, and just you could feel how badly they wanted to attack him. Just good stuff, I guess. And tomorrow's going to be an interesting day. The president will be at Ground Zero to lay a wreath. There's reports that he's not going to speak. He may speak. I'm not sure. But again, I think this is going to be good for his campaign. His polling numbers should give him a little bit of a bump. But more importantly, I think it's going to give the folks of who were there on 9/11. It's going to give them some closure and to be able to wake up and say, you know what? He's gone, and we don't have to fear the boogeyman anymore. Lex Luthor is gone. We don't need Superman. So that's a good thing. One of the things I thought, you know, the reason, I guess Bush turned down Obama's request for him to come join him, which I thought was a class thing to do. And it's one of the things I think you can say about Obama, is he is very much a class act. So he reached out his hand to Bush, and Bush kind of slapped it away. My only thought was possibly, you know, much like Bin Laden, much like finding Bin Laden, Bush couldn't find New York. So that's about all I can come up with. So we're going to take a quick break. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk with our good friend, Attorney Irwin Aronson. Stick around.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham. Massachusetts AFL-CIO President Robert Haynes says labor will fight a bill passed by the Democrats in the state house there that curbs health care collective bargaining rights for municipal public workers, including police and teachers. Haynes says labor and Democratic Massachusetts Governor Deval Patrick agree on the principles necessary for municipal health care reform in Massachusetts, and they agree that labor will maintain a meaningful role. In a printed statement, Haynes says that Governor Patrick is an outspoken and clear supporter of unions and collective bargaining. Haynes notes that the governor credits his mother's union job for keeping their family out of poverty as he grew up in Chicago. The Massachusetts AFL-CIO says, with a governor and a state senate both consistently on record in favor of municipal health care relief and collective bargaining, labor is confident that when legislation ultimately passes, collective bargaining will remain strong. Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker was against combined reporting before he was for it. Jesse Russell reports.
Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker has been faced with a reality check concerning one of his primary campaign platforms. Walker said multiple times on the campaign trail that he wanted to end combined reporting, but a Department of Revenue estimate says doing so could cost Wisconsin nearly $346 million in tax revenue. The law was enacted by former Governor Jim Doyle in 2009 and requires companies and any of their subsidiaries doing business with the state to file taxes as a single entity. Walker alleged during his campaign that the law was costing major corporations millions of dollars. Walker had this to say during his response to Doyle's 2010 State of the State address.
Governor Doyle and the Democrat-controlled legislature should start by repealing the job-killing combined reporting tax so that Wisconsin can keep good-paying jobs here.
Instead of repealing the law, Walker, after meeting with businesses, is proposing changes. One such change would prohibit the Department of Revenue from challenging the way companies report taxes on subsidiaries. 23 states currently have combined reporting laws. In Wisconsin, the idea was originally proposed by former Republican Governor Tommy Thompson as a way to battle tax evasion.
The United Steelworkers are presenting shareholder resolutions calling on oil companies to improve disclosures on oil refinery safety. The resolutions call on the boards of Marathon, Valero, and ConocoPhillips to fully disclose their oversight of process safety management, staffing levels, and inspection and maintenance of refineries and other equipment. The union hopes greater transparency will lead to safety improvements that will save lives in the oil industry. This newscast made possible in part by the American Federation of Teachers, a union of professionals, and by the National Association of Letter Carriers. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Standing tall against a multinational corporate agenda, The Rick Smith Show.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. So yesterday, State Representative Daryl Metcalf introduced a constitutional amendment to the state's house that would define marriage solely between one man and one woman. Our busy little Daryl also had his House Bill 934 moved to the state government committee today. You know, the one that restricts voting rights for people? You know, what a good Republican. I mean, you got to give him credit. First, he's got the birther bill, and then that bill that gets into your bedroom, and now the one that restricts your voting rights. And let's not forget his no rights at work agenda. Don't forget that. Wanting to make Pennsylvania a right to work for less state, or as my next guest loves to say, a right to shirk state. Remember, this is the party of paychecks. Don't you remember that? Am I the only one that remembers that Republicans claim to be the party of paychecks? What happened to that? Not one thing they have done to create a single job. Amazing stuff. Anyway, I've got our good friend Erwin Aronson on the line. Erwin, thanks for taking time for us.
Hey, good to be here, Rick. How are
you? I got to be honest. This Daryl Metcalf, radio gold. I mean, he never fails to deliver me some something to attack.
The gift that keeps on giving.
Kind of like herpes.
Kind of like herpes, a whole lot like herpes. Just keeps on growing.
Yeah, but you look at this right down the list. I would love to see if he would just cut and paste these bills from the Heritage Foundation or these other groups who say, here, do this, because it just seems to be part of the GOP playbook.
Well, what's really shocking is we look around us and we see so many critical, real, and meaningful problems and issues that working families face in merely trying to exist here in Pennsylvania. And they elect people, Democrats and Republicans alike, to be in their General Assembly, in the People's House, to deal with the problems that we can't wrap our arms around ourselves and alone. And this guy seems to spend every waking moment dealing with problems that don't exist.
Well, I mean, I guess
you know, he probably was one of those, probably was an LMV when he was a kid, a lunch money victim.
Yeah.
Probably one of those kids that, you know, just was begging for attention. That's all I can think of because I don't know very many people who think what he's putting out is important.
Well, I don't think there are very many people who think what he's putting out is even on the radar screen. Forget about it, important. I could live with insignificant, real legislative issues. These are not insignificant issues. They're very significant, but they're not real.
Right.
You know, maybe we ought to be dealing with something that is in the nature of putting up legislation for debate and time consumption at the expense of the taxpayers of Pennsylvania and Pennsylvania's General Assembly that prohibits cows from walking in Market Square in downtown Harrisburg.
Well, you know, don't give them any ideas.
Yeah, maybe you're right.
So let's talk about something that is important, Irwin. Yeah, we keep hearing this frame that's out there that the and basically being regurgitated ad nauseum that the unemployed are lazy, they're drunken, they're stupid, you know, all of this stuff that the right keeps pushing out there. They just don't want to work. When the reality is there's five people seeking every one job that might be available out there. And I look at Scott Perry, a Republican from the Dillsburg area, who has proposed House Bill 916, another one of these destructive anti-worker bills trying to really just eliminate people's ability to collect unemployment compensation. And before we start talking about this, I wanted to read from his press release and kind of make sure people understand where he is coming from. He says in his press release, this legislation was written with direct input from the Pennsylvania Chamber of Business and Industry and the National Federation of Independent Businesses. So basically, we already know from the beginning who's on his mind. Not one mention of a worker anywhere in his bill.
Well, it's curious as all get out. But more than curious, it's breathtaking. Because you're right, it is an anti-worker bill. But what it really is an anti-business bill. We need to understand and recognize that contrary to this right-wing lunatic drumbeat, people who are out of work through no fault of their own, aren't spending the money that they are entitled to as a function of unemployment insurance, and it is unemployment insurance, not unemployment welfare. Spend every penny of that money on their subsistence. This is the money that pays for the rent. It pays for the mortgage. It pays the gas bill, the electric bill, the telephone bill. Maybe puts part of a tank of $4 a gallon gas in the car so that they can go look for a job. It puts food on the table. It puts sneakers on the kids when they try to get back and forth to school. This is not money that pays for a trip to Bimini. This is money that keeps local businesses operating. And that's the fundamental idea behind unemployment compensation, not in 2011 alone, but it goes back to 1935 when unemployment compensation was first adopted as a legislative mandate, not merely in the United States, in Pennsylvania, but throughout the United States, because the genesis of the unemployment compensation law is to be found, guess where? In the Social Security Act, which, as a function of that law, provides the states, the several states, with a very substantial series of federal subsidies for their adoption and maintenance of conforming unemployment compensation systems. So this is contrary to what Representative Perry and his supporters would tell you, a fundamentally and shockingly anti-business piece of legislation that will result in, if passed, in greater unemployment because the very businesses that collect these subsistence payments from people who are unemployed are going themselves to have to lay people off when they can no longer afford to pay them.
And that's a that you never hear brought up. This just sounds right. And, you know, I got a tweet from Stephen Bloom, the Republican from the 199th, who came out and said, you know, that they found a little money, that the tax revenues were a little better off. He says, modest bump PA tax revenue, instant capital buzz to raise spending. Very troubling since the voters sent us to cut spending and taxes. And, you know, there's that frame out there that, you know, this last November was all about cut, cut, cut. It was all about slashing funding. It was all about cutting things like unemployment. It was all about cutting things that help people. And I don't believe that to be the case.
Well, look at the polls, but more importantly, look at the evidence. Yesterday, I was at the state capitol and saw you there. And there were 5,000 or more people that were not one of them, who came from every corner of Pennsylvania, who took a day off of work to be in Harrisburg, in their capital, in front of the People's House, to specifically and clearly articulate to the Representative Perrys of the world, to Governor Corbett, to all of those who try to articulate this phony story about being elected to come to Harrisburg to slash and burn and strafe. Their message was singularly clear, and their message was, don't take away our right, the right of our children to have a chance in our society by slashing education. Don't take away the right of people who have to drive our roads to have safe streets and safe highways by slashing the money that we pay, the subsistence wages, candidly, that we pay to people who work to keep our highways clean and our roads safe. Don't cut, don't slash, don't take away our libraries and our schools. Don't eliminate school nurses from school buildings. And if that is a mandate to cut and slash and burn and strafe and scorch the earth, then I must have missed a major league memo somewhere, and I've been at this long enough to know that I don't miss those kind of clear messages.
Right. You know, here's what gets me is, in going back to the unemployment situation, there's some federal money out there to help our unemployed. And on May 20th, the way I understand it, if something isn't done by the Metcalfs of the world, by the people who are running our government, the Republicans, there are going to be tens of thousands of people or hundreds of thousands of people across this state who aren't going to get that subsistence, if you will, because it's going to be cut off. And their inaction is going to cause mass suffering.
Well, I wish that it was merely inaction. I wish that it was just an inability to get down to the people's business. What's going to happen as of May 21, that's why that May 20th date is so important, is that the extended benefit program that is really aimed from the federal level right down to Main Street in your town and your community at assuring a continuation of unemployment benefits for the long-term unemployed, for the structurally unemployed, for the people who have exhausted their benefits, there needs to be the passage of some state legislation to merely continue that extended benefit program. And I believe that this is a much more cynical agenda than merely not being able to get it together to pass the right law. This is an effort to contrive a crisis, to force people into a situation where in order to retain the federally mandated extended benefit program, that they're going to have to make a trade, and the trade is going to be to increase taxes on people who work for a living and make taxes that workers pay on 100 cents of every dollar that they earn into the unemployment insurance system permanent. And at the same time, to cut benefits and restrict eligibility. Once again, they're going to use a crisis that is no fault or no cause of the victims of this economy as the basis upon which to slash and cut and burn and destroy. And that is not why anybody sent any member of the General Assembly, Democrat or Republican, senior or junior, teabagger or otherwise, to Harrisburg, not to cut, not to slash, not to destroy our communities, not to demoralize further people who have already been victimized by Wall Street game players and casino operators.
You know, but we keep hearing, and I'm looking at Scott Perry's press release, who says, you know, we're going to save a lot of money by enacting some of his reforms, he's calling them, like tightening the eligibility requirements, for people who reapply, basically cutting the amount being paid out, readjusting the calculation for the benefit rate, all of this stuff. And look, it, for those who don't know, all this means is we're reducing that minimum amount that we're already giving to people who've paid into this system. We're reducing their amount by that much more. That's the savings, stealing from people who are struggling already.
Rick, it's not just cutting. It's eliminating. They have language in Perry's legislation, and it's absolutely right. This was not written by Representative Perry. This was written by the Chamber of Business and Industry. The big business people, the people who happen to do business in Pennsylvania, but are national and global companies that are picking the pockets of the people. And it is not merely an effort to cut benefits, which would be draconian and offensive enough. It's an effort to eliminate eligibility for entire populations of people. They propose in there to create a new definition of willful misconduct that would disqualify people, that turns the tables from employers having to prove that a worker was engaged in some really offensive conduct, stealing, refusing to show up for work, lying, cheating, abusing customers and clients, and turn it into something else that basically is, instead of a no-fault system, a my-fault system. And it's an outrageous situation.
But here's the thing, Irwin, you know, when they make, when they, because I give credit where credit is due. The Republicans are masters at bumper sticker sloganeering. They're masters at simplistic arguments. You know, I think the death tax thing is linguistic mastery and genius. But what they do is they make things sound so simplistic and so common sense logical. That how can you argue with it? Oh, we just want people to go out and prove that they went and got a job, and we just want to make sure that those folks are really eligible. And we don't want folks who don't deserve a job and have gotten fired. We don't want them collecting either. But it makes very simplistic arguments that I think people listen to and go, yeah, it makes sense.
Well, you know what? It's really nice when you can boil something down to a sound bite. But these are big problems. The soundbite that people need to be focused on, that the Rick Perrys of the world need to be focused on, is a really simple soundbite. We got raped. We got raped by Wall Street that took our money and went to the casino with it and didn't care whether they won or lost. And that trickled across our society, not like a drip, 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 but like a tidal wave, a tsunami. And we're the victims of it. The recovery has been happening. Indeed, Pennsylvania all of a sudden has a little bit of a surplus. But the people who were unemployed 2 years ago as a result of that horse trading and that games playing are still unemployed today, and that's who Perry is aimed at. And let me tell you one other thing that is really maybe the most offensive, most unkind cut of all. In Pennsylvania today, every worker who is covered by unemployment compensation eligibility systems pays a tax to finance his and her unemployment insurance on every single penny of every dollar they earn.
Correct.
They get a dollar's worth of pay raise a week. They have their unemployment insurance tax rate increase immediately and irreversibly. Yet employers in Pennsylvania today pay unemployment insurance taxes only on the first $8,000 in any year in which each of their workers earn.
And when was the last time that tax was raised?
1984. And in 1984, that $8,000 represented 50%, roughly, of the statewide average annual wage. You know what it represents now, Rick?
What's that?
A hair over 19% of the statewide average wage.
Well, could probably explain why they keep telling us the system's broke.
Well, the system is broke because that was the very first of these lunatic right-wing efforts at slashing taxes. If they would have merely kept up with inflation, if the taxable wage on which employers pay unemployment insurance taxes had maintained that simple 50% rate, and understand how significant that is, in 1935 when they adopted the unemployment compensation law, the employer taxable wage base was 334% of the statewide average annual wage. Today, it's 19 plus a hair percent. And in 1984, when they adopted the taxable wage base, it was 50%. Had they just maintained that 50%, dramatically lower, breathtakingly lower than when we adopted the law in the first place, we would have a surplus in our unemployment compensation trust fund today. We wouldn't owe the federal government $3.2 billion, and that's billion with a B.
Again, more of these pro-wealth programs, pro-wealth programs, pro-corporate programs, anti-you and me programs.
Well, you know, I keep hearing about shared sacrifice, and what I'm finding out is we sacrifice and they share.
That is an excellent point. Oh, I'm telling you. So what should we do? The last question I got for you, what's the game plan here? We still have a couple of days to get on their behinds and push. Is there any legislation out there that would move us in the right direction that would maybe help us come May 20th to make sure that the folks in our community aren't the ones sacrificing while those at the very top share?
Well, there's several things we can do. Number one, Senator Tartaglione is working on amendments to the unemployment compensation law that would protect and continue the extended benefit program without imposing all of these other draconian measures. Number two, as we learned, those of us who were at the Capitol building in Harrisburg and tens of thousands more people who saw it on TV and in their morning papers today, we need to vigilantly and diligently work on our elected representatives. And work on them not in Harrisburg, but work on them at home. Let them know that we won't stand for this. Have our local business people, our local grocers, our local shoe repair shops, our local pharmacies, our local businesses, the local restaurants, also communicate to their legislators by us communicating with those businesses that if they support this Perry poison, that we won't support their businesses, and that they need to join with us and contact their state senators and their state house members and Governor Corbett's office and make those calls and visit those local offices and visit the homes, visit the school bus stops of members of the General Assembly's children, if we must, over these next several days and deliver the message, plain and simple, Pennsylvania can't stand to have this politically charged, greed-motivated effort at stripping our communities of the very minor subsistence income that the unemployed are entitled to keep body and soul together and to keep supporting our low businesses.
Amen. Right there. Call your representative's office early and often. Write letters. Do what you got to do. Write your school boards. Write the local newspapers. All of that all at once. Irwin, always great to talk with you. Always good information. I appreciate it.
Thanks. I appreciate getting the chance to speak with you and to have a few people hear what's going on, and you and I can work together to continue to be the truth squad in this little burg.
Outstanding. Irwin, thanks so much.
Thank you.
We're going to take a quick break right back after this. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. This is the Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
For the rest of us, Rick Smith.
Republican congressional leaders don't seem to be the quickest bunnies in the litter. Having taken their blunt budget acts to Medicare, Medicaid, Head Start, EPA, NPR, and dozens of other popular and effective programs, they then scampered to save one of the least popular and least effective federal programs on the books, the annual taxpayer subsidy for big oil. As gasoline prices were rising to $4 a gallon and higher, the House GOP voted unanimously to let the oil giants continue siphoning $4 billion a year out of our public treasury. All 241 of the Republican/Tea Party House members, with not even one dissenter in the bunch, declared that in this time of a supposed budget crisis, the neediest among us are not the elderly and the poor, but the little waifs of big oil. Meanwhile, ExxonMobil just announced a 69% leap in profits this year, while Chevron, ConocoPhillips, and others are enjoying similar jumps in theirs. Guess what percentage of those enormous profits the corporations are likely to pay in taxes? Zilch. Their lobbyists have punched such gaping holes in our tax code that they can escape paying anything for the privileges and benefits they get from America. Exxon, for one oily example, had a $19 billion profit in 2009, but not only did it pay exactly zero in federal income taxes, it manipulated the system to get a $156 million rebate from us. Likewise, Chevron and ConocoPhillips had multi-billion dollar profits that year, paid not a dime in taxes, and also got refunds. This is Jim Hightower saying, Republican lawmakers had a clear choice in dealing with the deficit. So why did they choose to cut off your granny's health care while helping these corporate billionaires make off like bandits? I guess it's a matter of who you really love. To get more of Jim Hightower's populist take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to, visit www.hightowerlowdown.com.
Who sends the investor class diving for their tax shelters? Rick Smith.
The rich pay too much taxes. The poor get way too much. Instead of schools, build prisons and lock the children up. We won't believe those lies again, because God is a Republican.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Remember, check out the website at therickssmithshow.com. Well, you know, it didn't take long. Didn't take long for some story to pop up about some teacher who said something stupid. Evidently in Texas, a ninth grade algebra teacher was suspended after making what some claim is an offensive comment to a Muslim student. The mother of the student told the local news there that the teacher told the student that, "I bet you're grieving over the death of Osama bin Laden." And she basically looked at him and said, "What you're talking about? What are you talking about?" Then he said, "I heard about your uncle's death." And she said, "Wow," because she understood that he was referring to Osama bin Laden being killed. So basically, this teacher... exactly what this person was thinking, nobody has any idea. But going to a Muslim student and saying something like, "Well, I'm sorry to hear it. I'll bet you're grieving about your uncle's death." That's one of those people who need to be... If the kid would have smacked her, I would have been okay with that. I think I would have been. Anyway, our Borowitz report. Andy Borowitz writes, in a startling measurement of public opinion since the successful mission to kill Osama bin Laden, Americans in record numbers are signing a petition to replace Congress with SEAL Team Number 6. Of course, they are the elite unit that took out the Al-Qaeda madman. The petition echoes the results of a new poll by the University of Minnesota's Opinion Research Institute, in which the Navy SEALs trounced Congress by a lopsided 97-2 margin, with the remaining 1% answering Superman. Professor Davis Logsdon of the University of Minnesota said that the numbers behind the numbers were even more striking. He said, by a wide margin, Americans favor SEAL Team 6 landing on the Capitol building with helicopters and taking Congress out by force. Professor Longston added, there is a broad consensus out there that Navy SEALs get things done, and that they would make C-SPAN more fun to watch. News of the petition and the survey caught the attention of the Secretary of Navy, Ray Mabus, who issued a strongly worded denial of rumors that SEAL Team 6 were practicing maneuvers on a life-size replica of the Capitol building constructed inside the abandoned linens and things in suburban Virginia. In other news, post bin Laden, the White House said they are no longer concerned about the American people being grossed out by images of Osama bin Laden. After all, they have been looking at Donald Trump for weeks. Elsewhere in reporting on bin Laden's death, Fox News has apologized for mispronouncing Barack Obama's name as George W. Bush. So, you know, again, you go back to this, what I was saying at the beginning, you know, the Republicans, they really don't know how to handle this. They have been so geared to Obama's a failure. I hope he fails. He's going to fail. And when this happens, a major success, they just don't know how to handle it. Just not at all. Nothing.
Lindsey Graham, who surprisingly in some of these issues has been a moderate, he's actually, believe it or not, although he's a conservative, he's been a spokesman for some sanity in the Republican Party, is now back to his old tricks, and he's calling for release of the dead photo, which I think accomplishes nothing. And I do agree with the Obama administration. If they do that, it'll just put Americans in harm's way. I mean, what would it accomplish?
Nothing. But, you know, they just don't know. They just don't know what to do. They've for so long been saying they want him to fail. For so long they've been saying, well, we want him to fail. We want this. We want that. I mean, in fact, Limbaugh came out early on.
I hope he fails.
Yeah. No matter what, I hope they fail. And they don't know how to handle this. They really don't. So, like I said earlier, I think Obama did the right thing, extending a hand to George W. Bush, saying, hey, this is an American thing. This should be a uniting thing. This is an opportunity for us to bring the country back together, much like 9/11 did. It really, I mean, Bush had an opportunity. There was about a month window, probably about a six-month window, where he could have been the uniting force in this country, could have done away with the polarization, and could have led this country into the 21st century stronger and more united. Yet what did he choose to do? Be more divisive and get all of the things that he wanted, all that he wanted passed. You know, I go back to that whole Mickey Herskowitz thing. You know, that, you know, if I got a chance to invade, I'm gonna make my mark, and I'm gonna get what I want passed. And what's frustrating is that that's exactly what they did. And it's this whole repeal the 20th century. Anyway, let's take a quick break. Right back after this with your calls. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425.
In an ocean of red, Rick Smith.
Chances are, when you took a shower this morning, an AFSCME member made sure that water was clean. When you drove to work, an AFSCME member maintained the road. When you rode an elevator, an AFSCME member inspected it. I'm David Filman, Executive Director of AFSCME Council 13, the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. AFSCME members enforce regulations, keep prisoners behind bars, take care of patients, protect the environment, and more. The work isn't glamorous, the salaries aren't high, but AFSCME members serve the public in every aspect of our daily lives. Chances are, you'll never see that AFSCME member working in a sewage plant, diving underwater to repair a bridge, or answering a 911 call. But aren't you glad they do? For more information, visit AFSCME13.org. We are AFSCME.
We make history. My name's Diane. I'm a single mom. I have twin boys who are 19, Alex and Tyler. We were a very close family, and I miss them a lot when they're away at school.
I definitely miss her. Yeah, I mean, she did our laundry back when we were home. Now we got to do it ourselves, so if nothing else, that's why we miss her.
Diane wanted individual health insurance for her sons, but she needed something affordable.
Health insurance is important because all it would take was one accident, and I could lose everything I worked for.
So she did her research and called Georgiana at Capital Blue Cross.
Georgiana was great right from the beginning. She stepped me through the entire process, and the coverage is wonderful. They have a great plan, and it's affordable. I feel like I can sleep at night knowing that my boys are covered.
My mom will always be the smartest one.
Text radio to 74574 for a sample quote. Message and data rates may apply. Your final quote may vary. Please don't text and drive. Capital Blue Cross is an independent licensee of the Blue Cross Blue Shield Association.
Remembering that united we bargain, divided we beg. Rick Smith.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. Check out the website at thericksmithshow.com. Remember a couple years ago when they were pushing this thing called Tabor, the Taxpayer Bill of Rights? Remember when they were hell-bent on, we needed this Taxpayer Bill of Rights, which was really, you know, as the word went, pretty much a chocolate-covered, turd. I think the ad said lemon, but it was really just horrible. It was one of these really just nasty pieces of legislation that would do what happened in Colorado. You know, Colorado's education system went from one of the top in the country to almost dead last immediately. The state was capped in funding. They couldn't get funding to plow their roads and do a lot of the things they did because of this quote-unquote taxpayer's bill of rights. Well, they're the godfather of the Tabor legislation. I can't make this up. I just cannot. He has been indicted for tax evasion. He's been indicted on 4 counts of tax evasion, also filing a false return, failing to file a return, and attempting to influence a public servant. 3 of the 4 counts, of course, are felonies, and the most serious of charges could bring 6 years in prison and a $500,000 fine. Again, you know, you look at this, and all of these people who kept saying, oh, well, you know, if we just had same tax rates and if we just did all of these things, we could lower our tax rates and everybody be happy. I don't care what the tax rate is. These folks, they don't think they have to pay. These folks, they think that everything society gives to them, all of the infrastructure, all of the court system, all of the roads, the education, the protection, the military, all that stuff should be free to them. And it should just be you and me paying the bill. And you look at what's going on in Texas right now. I mean, Texas is kind of the litmus test for me on budgets around the country. And yesterday, the Senate passed a budget there that would make some cuts to education and health care, but not nearly as deep as the ones in their House. But they have $176, $177 billion budget. It's a 2-year cycle. But $176 billion, they're talking about cutting $23 billion of it. And, of course, it's going to come from education. It's going to come from health care. It's going to come from things that people like you and me would use. And the reason I bring this up is because Tom Corbett wants us to be like Texas. So slash and burn education, slash and burn health care for folks who need it. But the reason I bring that up is last Thursday, in fact, there was one of their committees passed, the Texas House Ways and Means Committee, approved another one of these tax breaks for the very wealthy in the country. They passed this loophole for yacht owners. If you're going to go buy one of these big yachts, anything over $250,000, if your yacht costs $249,999, no tax break for you. But over $250,000 is a big tax break. And I love the rationale. Now, understand, this is probably going to cost the state, and they were estimating somewhere in the $3 billion range over the next several years. Their rationale I loved. They needed this piece of legislation because Florida had a similar law. And they were afraid that their billionaires would leave Texas and go to Florida to buy their boats. And again, it's another example of that beggar thy neighbor race to the bottom that we've been talking about. Texas faces massive budget problems, one of the worst in the country. And yet, I guess they have enough money. They have enough money to put out these handouts. And you know, what's surprising to me is that most states are having trouble right now because of the massive Bush-era economic collapse. But what's interesting about Texas is only about a third of their shortfall is because of the Bush debacle, which is surprising to me. So I guess the question then becomes is, why is Texas in such bad shape if, unlike most of the other states, they're not really suffering the massive consequences of the Bush collapse? Well, pretty simple. Years of chronic revenue shortages, years of these kind of tax breaks to the millionaires and billionaires. When you give the baby away with the bathwater, not to mention the washcloth, the soap, the plug, the tub, and the whole nine yards, what are you left with? No revenue. So then you got to start slashing programs. Not to mention, they slash property taxes, they slash business taxes. This is what happens when you hand out massive amounts of resources to special interests. This is what happens when you give out these massive exemptions to corporations and your wealthy campaign donors. which is what brings us back to the proposed handouts to the very, very wealthy. You know, this whole cut for you and me and massive handouts for them is, I got to be honest, something that we've got to stand up and fight against. I mean, the Bloom tweet, well, they found a little money and now they don't want to cut anything. Yeah, I don't want to cut $1 billion for education. Sorry. In Texas, the Republican proposal is going to cut almost $8 billion from the Texas public schools. 60,000 students are going to lose their college financial aid. Upwards of 97,000 teachers out on their ear. They're going to slash 9,300 government jobs. They're going to cut Medicaid. They're going to slash. And all I keep seeing is cut, constrict. What happened to the Republican Party that was going to be the party of paychecks? Remember the Republicans were going to be the job creators? Where are the jobs? When all I keep seeing is 97,000 teachers, 9,300 government workers out the door, where's the creation? 60,000 plus college students going to lose their financial aid. Where's the job creation, Jake? Where is it? Because I'm not seeing it, man.
Well, I mean, the only thing I can think of, they're trying to go after and destroy certain segments of our society, and their answer has always been privatization. Maybe long-term plan. Maybe they're crazy enough to believe that will actually create jobs by having services which you destroy being privatized. I mean, other than that, I can't think of a logical reason, even though I disagree with that totally. From that perspective, it does make sense, and I think they're crazy enough to do it.
That's why on Monday we're going to D.C. to participate in a protest against our governor, who's, you know, and it just boggles the mind why this guy would go to D.C. and pair up with Scott Walker at this American Federation for Children summit that is advocating privatizing public education. Why put himself into that unless there's a boatload of money on the back end, unless there's a boatload of campaign money, unless there's a boatload of influence? It makes no sense. It really makes no sense to me at all why this governor would be dumb enough to go to this and to put himself in the middle of what really, honestly and truthfully, is going to be a firestorm. But again, it comes down to the money. These people have the big bucks. And
I mean, we look at all the states that are having problems right now, and they're going after unions, you know, name them off, Pennsylvania, New Jersey, Michigan, Ohio, Wisconsin. The one thing they all have in common is a large influx of a lot of money from arch-conservative, very wealthy people who are hell-bent on privatization and destroying unions. So, every state has that in common.
So this is the movement. And what, again, you know, what I've been saying for the longest time, it shows how little we know about our past. It shows how little we know about what has happened before. How did we get the 8-hour day? How did we get weekends? Where did vacations come from? Were these things that were just bestowed upon us because we were just wonderful employees? The answer is obviously no. The benevolent corporation just didn't say, you know, I like you so much, I'm going to give you more of the profit. That didn't happen. It happened because people stood together, people fought back, and people demanded a fair shake. And all of the decisions we're seeing from the Supreme Court especially are repealing and going back on those gains. The Republican parties, they know they've got us hostage right now. They know that they can help to repeal most of the advancements that have happened. And when we come back here in a minute, we're going to talk with Larry Spivak about the Haymarket Square massacre. You know, you stop and you think about the history of labor. Really very, very bloody history. Confrontation. But also another way to be divided. I mean, I marvel at the amount of money that had been spent on division. When someone like Jay Gould says, I can easily pay half the working class to kill the other half, he was right. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, Larry Spivak, back after this.
Radio of, for, and by. We the Working People. The Rick Smith Show.
The Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham. Massachusetts AFL-CIO President Robert Haynes says labor will fight a bill passed by the Democrats in the state house there that curbs health care collective bargaining rights for municipal public workers, including police and teachers. Haynes says labor and Democratic Massachusetts Governor Deval Patrick agree on the principles necessary for municipal health care reform in Massachusetts, and they agree that labor will maintain a meaningful role. In a printed statement, Haynes says that Governor Patrick is an outspoken and clear supporter of unions and collective bargaining. Haynes notes that the governor credits his mother's union job for keeping their family out of poverty as he grew up in Chicago. The Massachusetts AFL-CIO says with a governor and a state senate both consistently on record in favor of municipal health care relief and collective bargaining, labor is confident that when legislation ultimately passes, collective bargaining will remain strong. Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker was against combined reporting before he was for it. Jesse Russell reports.
Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker has been faced with a reality check concerning one of his primary campaign platforms. Walker said multiple times on the campaign trail that he wanted to end combined reporting, but a Department of Revenue estimate says doing so could cost Wisconsin nearly $346 million in tax revenue. The law was enacted by former Governor Jim Doyle in 2009. And requires companies and any of their subsidiaries doing business with the state to file taxes as a single entity. Walker alleged during his campaign that the law was costing major corporations millions of dollars. Walker had this to say during his response to Doyle's 2010 State of the State address.
Governor Doyle and the Democrat-controlled legislature should start by repealing the job-killing combined reporting tax so that Wisconsin can keep good-paying jobs here.
Instead of repealing the law, Walker, after meeting with businesses, is proposing changes. One such change would prohibit the Department of Revenue from challenging the way companies report taxes on subsidiaries. 23 states currently have combined reporting laws. In Wisconsin, the idea was originally proposed by former Republican Governor Tommy Thompson as a way to battle tax evasion.
The United Steelworkers are presenting shareholder resolutions calling on oil companies to improve disclosures on oil refinery safety. The resolutions call on the boards of Marathon, Valero, and ConocoPhillips to fully disclose their oversight of process safety management, staffing levels, and inspection and maintenance of refineries and other equipment. The union hopes greater transparency will lead to safety improvements that will save lives in the oil industry. This newscast made possible in part by the American Federation of Teachers, a union of professionals, and by the National Association of Letter Carriers. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Your proud defender of the American dream, Rick Smith.
Come all ya good workers, good news to you out there. Oh, now the good old union has come in here to drill. Which side are you on? Which side are you on?
And welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Remember, check out the website at thericksmithshow.com. This year is the 125th anniversary of the saying of the Jay Gould, the famous saying, I could easily hire one half of the working class to kill the other half during the Great Southwestern Railroad strike of 1886. It's also the 125th anniversary of the Haymarket Square Massacre. And here to talk to us a little bit about that is Larry Spivak. He's the president of the Illinois Labor History Society. He's also regional director of AFSCME 31 out in Illinois. Larry, thanks for taking time for us.
Well, thank you for having me.
You know, this another one of those moments in labor history that I don't know that our schools spend much time on, but a very influential moment, a pivotal moment in our labor history.
Well, Rick, some people could say that the Haymarket Affair, or tragedy, as we like to call it, as opposed to riot, which it wasn't, is maybe one of the most influential single events affecting labor throughout the entire world. Because, of course, it was the event that really created International Labor Day and worldwide movement of workers.
So walk me through this, because, you know, we hear some reports, you know, there were, you know, the workers, you know, there was somebody there who caused all this trouble. I believe it was probably someone put into place, an agent provocateur, if you will. I often listen to that phony phone call in Wisconsin where Governor Walker it was proposed that they send in troublemakers, and a sitting governor today even said, you know, we'd thought about it.
Well, that's always been my theory, too. We'll never know, of course, who knows, maybe one day we will, but nobody's ever really known who threw the bomb, but it's probably the best theory. The only other theory that has any merit is that it was just some independent person who had whatever grievances they had. It's always kind of interesting how Albert Parsons and August Bees being asked, you know, about this, and Albert Parsons would say, let's see, who would bring their women, their wife and children to a rally where a bomb is going to be thrown?
Right.
You know, he was there, and then he left. But it's just an amazing story of American history, especially the fact is that so few Americans even know about it. Even more amazing that here in Chicago, you could talk to anybody. I speak at colleges and schools, and the only students that ever know what the Haymarket Affair is are from foreign countries, other countries. So this is an amazing story.
So walk me through this. Yesterday, I believe, there was a demonstration, and this that was broken up. Walk me through this, if you would.
With respect to the story of the Haymarket.
Yes.
It is a back in 1884, actually, the new labor movement organization, the Federation of Trades and Labor Assembly, called for a strike by May 1st of 1886 to win the eight-hour day. So by May 1st, and across the country, there was a national strike of 350,000 workers, and a quarter of the organized workforce was in Chicago, being the fastest-growing city, the most industrialized city in America at that point. And 80,000 workers in Chicago were on strike, and already 10,000 by May 1st had won the eight-hour day just by their strikes. There were over 100 strikes in Chicago. And so by May 1st, this already had become such a national movement against big business interests that the fear that was in the heart of what I call the corporate agenda was ever present. And so there was a major strike and lockout at the McCormick Reaper family, the family that owns the Chicago Tribune and that had been fighting unions, iron molders workers primarily. And August Spies, the editor of a German newspaper, the Arbiter Zeitung, was speaking at a rally and then visited with the striking. When the scabs came out of the factory, the workers were jeering, and August Spies was there to witness this and ended up writing about it. He was one of the major labor organizers of the day. Suddenly, when the scabs came out and there was all the jeering, the police came and started shooting, and in the end, two workers were shot. Killed. And so many workers were horrified by this continued event of police brutality against the workers who were on strike that they called for a meeting at the Haymarket Square in Chicago, which could hold 20,000 people. But they called for a rally the next day, which would have been Tuesday, May 4th, and that of 1886. So there was this rally. It was poorly organized. Only about 2,500 people showed up, but 176 police officers were in formation. The Chicago mayor was there, Carter Harrison. He told the police to go home at 10 o'clock because it was a peaceful rally. But so the mayor left. The police stayed because their commander, their Inspector Bonfield, as he was called, Blackjack Bonfield, because he liked to beat workers on strike, had the troops, the police officers move in on the workers, of which there were only 250 left, at this rally at the Haymarket. And a Methodist lay preacher named Samuel Fielden, who became one of the martyrs, was speaking, and the inspectors moved in on them and said, "I command you in the name of the people to disperse." Samuel Fielden said from the hay wagon, "This is a peaceable meeting," and in that moment, a bomb, laden with dynamite. It was a metal sphere, was seen hissing through the crowd from this little vestibule right near the hay wagon, maybe 20 feet away, and landed at the foot of a police officer, blew up, killed the police officer, and the police started shooting. The police were the only ones armed. There's illustrations of showing workers shooting back at the police, but they're all false. There's no report that the police ever, or that the workers ever came armed.
Well, here again, another example of where the media then takes over and puts their spin on it.
Well, the media, which was all, you know, owned by large corporations.
By the company they were striking against.
You know, the
right.
Tribune was the paper of record, like the New York Times is or the Chicago Tribune is today in Chicago in the Midwest. And so they immediately, corporate America and the Tribune called for a bounty on basically labor leaders. And it really was an eye for an eye type of thing. Seven police officers died. So they said, let's round up eight workers, eight labor leaders. Let's destroy the labor movement. That's all this was about, which is why I agree with your theory about who did it, because this was the pretext to destroy the labor movement. And that was essentially what the state's attorney said we need to do. You know, it was really became, for those who don't know the story, a great trial followed that lasted for a couple months where eight men who were basically tried by a kangaroo court and eventually got pardoned. Unfortunately, four of them were hanged and one died in prison the night before, but became the cause to left for workers around the world because it was an example of trying to stamp out a labor movement during this period of great industrialization and labor organizing around the world. So it became the an incredible and amazing story of an international labor movement. And today, or over this last week, we've been celebrating it, and we're really excited because we, you know, for the first time ever, organized labor in a big way. The National AFL-CIO had a speaker there. The Chicago Federation of Labor and the Illinois Federation of Labor were all participants in this, helping us put on this incredible week celebration, especially Sunday when we celebrated the unveiling and the restoration of the Haymarket Martyrs Monument. And if I could just say one thing about that, the Martyrs Monument is a statue of liberty to workers around the world. It is known by workers everywhere. It's people march. Billions of workers are on holiday because of the martyrs who gave their lives for the cause of the right to organize, the right to free speech, the right to peacefully assemble. And other than Americans, people celebrate this everywhere. And the Illinois Labor History Society is the deed holder to the monument, so it's also a National Historic Landmark, and we were given, we have the obligation to keep care of it. And it's fallen into a state where it just needs to be restored, and so anybody that wants to help out can go online to IllinoisLaborHistory.org and donate. We've unveiled the statue. We're still trying to raise the funds, but we need the help of workers around the world and from labor unions everywhere. And IllinoisLaborHistory.org, and this beautiful restoration was unveiled with the Secretary Treasurer of the AFL-CIO, the President of the General President of the Laborers Union, and it was a wonderful ceremony on Sunday where a couple thousand workers showed up. It was amazing. A couple thousand workers at the Haymarket statue, which for most of the century was off limits to workers because of the Cold War. So it's an incredible story that's taking place and unfolding in America.
No, we'll make sure we get a link over to that at our site at therickSmithShow.com. Just click on Larry Spivak's name. It'll take you right there. You know, real quick, can you tell me some of the things that, you know, because I find when I talk to people that they really have no idea where weekends came from, where unemployment compensation came from, where, you know, the 8-hour day, you know, on and on, all of these things that we today seem to take for granted as they always were because the benevolent corporation gives to us. Some of the things that came out of this, if you could just chalk off a couple. And I'm sure you could go all day, but
yeah, well, anything that is a benefit pretty much enjoyed by workers is because of the struggle of workers and the right to unionize, the fight to unionize, the fight to collective bargaining and collective association. So, you know, you're talking about, you know, like that great bumper sticker, the labor movement that people gave you the weekend, really pensions, social legislation that's like workers' compensation and Fair Labor Standards Act and the minimum wage and all those social legislation things grow out of this movement of workers organizing collectively, where that's one of the great things about the labor movement is that the benefits, the collateral benefits to every worker is enjoyed because of what perhaps, you know, right now only 12% of the population are organized, but who work. But everything that we fight for now we're trying to defend, you know, in the public sector pensions because they were lost in the private sector. This onslaught of even Democratic politicians to get rid of pensions and
Now, are you surprised at how things have kind of transpired these last couple of months? Because, you know, there was a downward kind of thought about labor. You know, the right had done a masterful job. The wealth class had done a very masterful job of saying, well, you don't need those. Those unions were, you know, back in the old dirty coal days when you know, there were bad people. But we're better than that now.
Right. Absolutely. You know, if it wasn't for the United Mine Workers, even more people would be dying in mines. I mean, you know, the factories that are unorganized still in America, you know, the health standards are always worse. Every state that's a, what they call a right-to-work state, everything in terms of social legislation is just worse for workers. So we, our benefit, the benefit of what unionization does for workers everywhere is pretty much untold by the media, because the media hates, you know, is run by the, you know, it's like the Koch brothers in Wisconsin. They fund the politicians and especially, you know, the Republican politicians. And it's unfortunate that so many Democrats feel they have to jump on board because of the deficit system that's created by corporate America, having their taxes brought down to levels that are unheard of in any developed country. Labor laws that are the worst in the world and makes it impossible to organize in America. And I think Americans are beginning to get the word and get the feeling that something's not right here, that I'm born into a society that promised, you know, something better than my parents, and now that's not even considered.
Not even possible. And the reason that I had you on tonight is because I think it's important that people hear about the battles of the past, because unfortunately, there's part of me that believes we're going to have to refight every one of those battles again.
I think it's becoming the case here in Illinois. Every single public employee is under attack. You know, the private sector workers have suffered for 30 years in terms of no wage increase. They've stagnated. And because of this corporate agenda that can't, insatiable desire for profits is out of control. So Wall Street is just beating up every worker in America, and some people vote against their own self-interest and not realizing it. Our job is to help them understand that this history, this glorious history of collective association, is not just for rich people, but it should be for middle class and for working families. So,
absolutely.
Yes.
Absolutely. Larry, I appreciate your time. Thanks so much.
Okay, thank you.
Larry Spivak, president of the Illinois Labor History Society, and also a regional director of AFSCME 31. There's a link at our site if you want to donate some money to restore the Workers' Monument right at the RickSmithShow.com. Just click on Larry's name. We're going to take a quick break right back after this. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425.
Family values are more than slogans. The Rick Smith Show.
On June 25, 1938, President Franklin Delano Roosevelt signed the Fair Labor Standards Act into law. Viewed as one of the final pieces of legislation of FDR's New Deal and the single most worker-friendly piece of legislation ever written, the Fair Labor Standards Act of 1938 was a victory not only for labor unions, but for workers, families, and children across the country. FDR called the new law the most far-reaching, far-sighted program for the benefit of workers ever adopted in this or any other country. This visionary piece of legislation put a ceiling over hours and a floor under wages, mandating a 44-hour work week, a 25-cent minimum wage, and time and a half for overtime. The Fair Labor Standards Act was later amended to 40 hours per week and 40 cents per hour. The law also excluded children from working dangerous jobs and set standard conditions for the employment of child workers to avoid continued exploitation of children. The Fair Labor Standards Act has been changed or amended at least 43 different times. These alterations have been used both to expand worker protections, such as raising the minimum wage, prohibiting age discrimination, and requiring equal pay, and to restrict and take away protections such as the Taft-Hartley Act and the 2004 Fair Pay Amendment. Today, we take the 40-hour work week, minimum wages, overtime, and child labor protections for granted. But up until the passage of the Fair Labor Standards Act, workers were at the mercy of their employers, and children were dying in industrial accidents. This Rick Smith Show Labor History Moment was made possible by a grant from the Labor Education Center at IUP. For more information, visit www.therickSmithShow.com.
You helped to turn America blue. Now let's keep it that way. The Rick Smith Show.
Thank you.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Remember, check out the website at therickSmithShow.com. Our friends over at the Keystone Research Center issued a press release today quoting a new study from the Economic Policy Institute that says more than 26,000 Pennsylvania jobs have been lost or displaced since 1994 as a result of the U.S. trade deficit with Mexico. EPI points out that prior to the passage of NAFTA, the U.S. had a $1.6 billion trade surplus with Mexico that supported 29,400 American jobs. Here we go, fast forward 18 years, and what we've seen is we've seen imports from Mexico growing at a faster rate than exports from the U.S. So what do we have now? Well, we have this massively large trade deficit. In fact, we've lost over 682,000 jobs since 1994. It has cost us almost $100 billion. Now remember, when they sold this to us, NAFTA was going to, it's going to create jobs. Oh, we're going to have jobs for everybody. It's going to raise the standard living in Mexico. So all the Mexicans are going to rise up and we're going to all be holding hands singing Kumbaya. Has that happened? No, it hasn't happened. And you look at the reality is, according to the EPI report, of the 50 states, we rank 20th in the share of jobs and 8th in the number of raw number of jobs lost due to our growing trade deficit with Mexico. So Pennsylvania is really being harmed by this. In fact, what's interesting is 61% of all the jobs that were lost, around 415,000, they've been in manufacturing. So stop and think about this. The jobs where we were going to be able to create things and export them are gone. So we no longer have a dog in the fight. We no longer have a team. We no longer have a boxer in the ring, whatever analogy you want to use. We don't have anything to compete with. All we're trading, and I go back to a good friend, Richard Levins, who said, you know, we're trading cheap toasters for jobs. You know, every time one of those cheap products come in, what goes out is a job, not another product. Trade is about trading things. I'll make a coffee mug, you make a pen, we'll trade them. And that's not happening. What we're doing is we're trading our standard of living for cheap plastic junk. And if you look at what happened yesterday in Mexico, there was a massive mine explosion. Killed 5 miners. Today, there are 9 more still trapped. They fear dead because of the explosion, I guess, was so powerful that it ripped off a 15-year-old boy's arm who was working on a conveyor belt outside the pit. Because he had been pulling up and emptying out the baskets that carried the coal. A 15-year-old kid. 15-year-old. Is this what we're set to compete against? We did this 100 years ago. We had kids working in the coal mines 100 years ago, and we're competing against people today. Today. Who allow their kids to do it. Now, Mexico has a law against it. It's against the law. But who's going to enforce it? I mean, I've said this before. We can have all of the laws that we want. If no one's there to enforce them, what good is the law? This is why you need to have unions. This is the reason you need to have the ability for people on the site to say no. And you look at these mines in Mexico, I guess I could start a mine myself. I don't know anything about mining, but in Mexico, I guess if I had a couple of bucks, I could go start a mine and pay people to go down in a hole and dig me whatever out I want. Without any fear of repercussion. These are the people we're trading with. These are the people who we're competing against. And yet, all I hear coming out of Washington, all I hear coming out of corporate America is we need more of these agreements, not less. We don't need to go back and renegotiate the horrible trade policy that is. We need to continue it because, you know, the reason we're not doing as well with trade is because it's not free enough.
We should have free trade with everybody. Which means now you look at the Obama administration pushing on the free trade agreements with South Korea and Panama. The Obama administration official said yesterday that they expected technical discussions about the agreement to begin tomorrow. That would be today, capital aids, in the first step of the approval process. President Obama has made increasing American trade job one. And again, as I've said, trade is great. If you have something to trade with besides your soul, which is what we're trading. The White House said that they were hoping for a quick approval of the largest deal, which was the South Korean trade agreement. But, of course, the Republicans demanded that Panama and Colombia go with them. But after months of talks, the Obama administration settled with Panama. So it's just going to be Panama and South Korea right now. They're going to hold off on Colombia. Now, they're saying that with Panama, it's because the government there has agreed to some greater tax transparency. And oh boy, I can't wait to see what kind of transparency we get out of Panama. Because I'm assuming that Panama is going to be the next Cayman Island, where all of the profits from corporate America go to avoid American taxes. Because after all, we've got a free trade agreement. Isn't that wonderful? And the Republicans are upset because Colombia didn't make it through. And why? Well, because they want to be business friendly, and what can be more business friendly than taking union members and union leaders up into planes and pitching them out the window? At least that's the way they see it. So we're going to be hearing about this in the coming days, so get ready for it. John Boehner had the quote of the article that I just love. He applauded the president's announcement, and he says, "Now it's time we move to expand market access for American-made goods in all three of these nations." And again, I go back to what goods. You've got to be able to create something. And Max Baucus had another good quote. He was he had major concerns over American beef getting into South Korea. And the reality is the South Koreans don't want our beef. Why? Because they don't want steroids rammed down their throats, which is what we're going to do. And the claim is that the South Korean deal will support 70,000 jobs here in the U.S. I guess the other question we should be asking, if it's going to support 70,000, how many is it going to cost?
Which industry are they projecting?
Agriculture, beef, a couple hundred jobs in autos. That's about
haven't we heard this tune before?
Only every time a trade agreement comes up.
I think Peru enters in my mind.
Well,
how do we make out?
Well, we haven't made out well. You look at the story I talked about yesterday about the U.S. steel imports coming in from Canada and Mexico that have risen 32.5% from the month before and over 19% from the year before. And again, you know, it goes back down to the people who are making the decisions, people who are lobbying and influential are saying, all we care about is the market condition. All we care about is the consumers of steel. We don't care about the workers. And in there lies the problem. And what I've been saying for some time now, if you want to solve our budget problems, if you want to solve our deficits and our debt, trade is where you begin. Because if we were able to level off these massive trade deficits we have with China and Mexico and virtually everybody else in the world, if you were able to kind of bring them in the line to where we're close, I don't expect to be even, and I don't want to win every battle. It would be nice. It'd be nice if we had surpluses with everybody. I don't even want that. I'd like to at least be close to where we're not talking almost $1 trillion a year in trade deficits. That $1 trillion, that goes right to our budget deficit. So, in the coming days, we're going to be hearing a lot about the budget, a lot about our debt. Which is why when we come back, I'm going to talk with Garrett Epps. He is a former Washington Post reporter, novelist, legal scholar, constitutional law professor. I'm going to talk about his piece, The Speech Obama Could Give, The Constitution Forbids Default. Right back after this.
The Rick Smith Show, changing America for the better.
Council 13 members, did you know that you have voluntary benefits available to you that you can pay for through the ease of payroll deduction? AFSCME Council 13 offers a voluntary benefits package to help provide money when you or a covered family member incurs one of these life events, accidents, critical illness, disability, or death. No one can avoid life's unfortunate situations. However, AFSCME Council 13 has provided you with the opportunity to ease the financial burden on your family by preparing now. Find out more about Trustmark's voluntary benefits. BBS Benefit Solutions can help you get the security you need. Call BBS at 1-866-902-2561. Again, call BBS at 1-866-902-2561.
Hi, I'm Bob Snyder, president of Teamsters Local 776 here in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. For more than 100 years, Teamsters have been standing together to create a better tomorrow. We Teamster members are your friends and neighbors. Teamsters move goods across the nation, take care of seniors, serve and protect our community, and so much more. We are hardworking, dedicated professional workers, united to make our lives, our communities, and our nation stronger. If you want to be part of the team, join the Teamsters for a better tomorrow. Contact us at 1-800-692-6280. That's 1-800-692-6280. Or visit our website at TeamstersLocal776.org. We are people helping people.
Since the investor class, diving for their tax shelters. Rick Smith.
At every trough you stop to feed. With your arrogance, your ignorance and greed. Now here come the cuts and redundancy. Through the absolute indifference. Avarice, incompetence, your arrogance, your ignorance, your greed.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. So tomorrow, I guess, Vice President Joe Biden will be hosting a bipartisan congressional group to discuss raising the debt limit. And what I find interesting is one of my Tea Party, constitutional experts. I figured that one out. He told me that raising the debt ceiling is unconstitutional. And in fact, to him, borrowing money in general, to him, seems to be unconstitutional. Again, I question whether he actually read the thing or not. But that's another whole nother argument. But I read this great piece, and I had to get the author on. His name's Garrett Epps. He's a novelist, legal scholar, constitutional law professor at the University of Baltimore. Wrote this great piece, The Speech Obama Could Give. The Constitution Forbids Default. There's a link at our site at thericksmithshow.com. Just click on Garrett Epps' name. It'll take you right there. Professor, welcome to the program.
Hi, Rick. Good to be here.
I look at this, and I've got this friend of mine who's a diehard Tea Party enthusiast who tells me that raising the debt ceiling is unconstitutional.
Well, there is nothing in the Constitution about a debt ceiling at all. The Article 1, Section 8 makes very clear that Congress has the power to borrow money, so I think a good dose of boredom for a lot of these people would cure a lot of their problems. And the boredom, I mean, is to sit down and read all 7,000 words of the Constitution. I don't think many of them have done that.
No, they don't want to do that. It's easier to listen to the radio.
Yes.
And it's easy to listen to the people who are, just out there bloviating this anti Obama stuff, and this is just part of it.
Anything that the far right doesn't like in 2011 is suddenly unconstitutional. As far as I can tell, the claim is that the Republican National Committee in 2010 wrote the Constitution and sent it back in time, like the Terminator, to 1787, and it contains every item of far-right ideology. I can't find it in the actual text, and so I like to call what these people believe in Da Vinci Code originalism. That is, it's all there, it's just hidden.
Right.
in some mysterious code language that only they can read.
I have a whole bunch of these folks who love to tell me the things that aren't there, because I've read it. I'm not going to say that I'm like you, a scholar and, a law professor, but, I've read the words and I have a basic understanding, and I've never found that in there as well. But this is a real problem, because I do believe what's going on is the Republicans are holding the country hostage in order to advance their ideology, in order to get their pound of flesh. And I guess my first question would be, what advice do you give the president and the vice president as this hostage situation moves forward?
Well, it would be awfully nice and good for the country if the two sides would act like grown-ups and say the following. We all have a stake in making sure that American credit in the world market is rock solid, because without the ability of other countries to rely on our debt instruments, the world financial system will crumble. And I've lately been reading a history of the Great Depression, and the resemblances between this year and 1931 are really scary to me. In 1931, people said, "Oh, the economy's starting to come back, recovery's just underway, we're gonna make it." And a series of financial shocks reversed that, until by early 1933, the banking system had collapsed, and the country was in free fall. It doesn't have to happen, I don't think, but I think the worst possible thing that could happen to this country and to the world would be for people to begin to get the idea that America's debt will be serviced and paid only if a minority of the Republican caucus in the House gets their entire far-right program.
Which, to be honest, in my opinion, and you can correct me if you think I'm wrong, is basically repealing the entire 20th century and undoing all of the progress that working class folks have won.
The far right, the Tea Party right, is very frank that they want to move back to 1912. That's the last year they think things have been run properly.
The income tax.
That was before we had income tax. Yep. It was before we had popular election of senators. It was before we had votes for women. They have a shirt they sell, 1913, worst year ever, because that's the year in which the Constitution was remodeled through the Article 5 process to make it the instrument suitable for running a modern nation. And if we take that path, I think we are a country in decline, and I think that the decline may very quickly become irreversible. It's a very frightening time, and it's also infuriating if, like me, you've spent 20 years trying to understand what the Constitution really does say and doesn't say. And one of the things that it does say very clearly, one thing that was foreseen by the framers of the 14th Amendment, was a situation where a small political faction would try to use the national debt as a political weapon, and that is really forbidden by the 14th Amendment, Section 4, which was the subject of the article that you mentioned earlier.
Right, and the text that you quote is the validity of the public debt of the United States authorized by law, including debts incurred for payment of pensions and bounties for services in suppressing insurrection or rebellion, shall not be questioned.
Yes, that's extraordinary language. It doesn't say must be paid. It doesn't even say must be paid on time. It says shall not be questioned. And in my judgment, the people who are saying, and they're quite openly saying this now in Washington, oh, default wouldn't be so bad. It would teach the government a lesson. It would make us live within our means. I think these people are at war with not just the spirit of the Constitution, but what it says. I would like to see some consideration of this provision of the Constitution in the current debate. People act as if it isn't there.
Yeah, I'm right there with you. You know, but one of the things that I try to focus on is what it would look like if we did default. Who would be harmed? Because who holds the majority of our debt? We keep hearing the rhetoric about the Chinese, and I'm quite frankly, bothered by the fact that the Chinese hold a portion of our debt, but it's less than 10%. Most of our debt is held by Social Security and by American investors.
That's certainly true. And even if it is, even whatever percentage is held abroad, we can't operate as the most powerful economic nation in the world if people don't believe we will abide by our IOUs. That it simply will be the end of the dollar as a reserve currency, really the end of the current financial system. And what replaces it, I think, will be a good deal less advantageous for us.
Because the point I'm trying to make to people is, you know, most of us hold the debt. It's our pension funds. It's investments that we have. It's the treasury bonds and all those things that we invest in. And if that goes belly up and they don't pay out, we lose. The working people lose.
Yes, and the banking system would be in serious trouble because tremendous numbers of those T-bills are bought by financial institutions to park their cash while they wait to find productive uses for it. And if that dries up and the banks can't cover their obligations, we run the risk of something like the bank panic of 1932, where ordinary people suddenly saw their savings disappear or at best become frozen so that they couldn't access them for quite a long period of time. That would absolutely choke off any chance of a recovery if this recovery peters out, economists are now saying we're looking at the Japanese situation of a lost decade.
That would be catastrophic.
Absolutely
catastrophic. Well, let me ask you this, Professor Epps. You know, we keep hearing a lot about this debt ceiling. Where did it come from?
The debt limit was put in place early in the 20th century at some point, and I don't have the year right in front of me.
So this isn't something of a constitutional making, because I had someone making the argument at breakfast the other morning. I had someone making that this is a constitutional limit. And again, I went back. I couldn't find anything that talked about it in the Constitution. But there's a belief out there that this debt ceiling is somehow constitutional.
No, the Constitution doesn't require it. And indeed, it's a very odd way to manage national finances. Most modern countries don't have a debt limit. It's understood that when the legislature authorizes expenditures, it's authorizing whatever it takes to acquire the funds to make them. And it's a very odd system in this country to allow lawmakers to vote for programs that they support and then turn around and say, oh, but we don't support borrowing money to fund them. We didn't vote for that. So, there really is no real reason for a debt ceiling, and it's certainly not dictated by the Constitution.
So would this be an argument for the right's call for a constitutional amendment, a budget amendment, a balanced budget amendment?
Well,
I'm not in favor of, but...
I think if people want the federal government not to have the power to borrow, that's the route they need to take. There's nothing in the current instrument, the Constitution that we have, the actual Constitution, explicitly authorizes Congress to borrow money. And it further says that debt, borrowed as authorized by law, cannot be questioned subsequently. You know, I interpret that to mean that the federal government has an obligation to keep current in all our obligations, even if that means borrowing more money than some of the people on Capitol Hill would like us to do.
So have you had gotten much traction, any traction on this piece that you've written, which I think is fantastic?
It's certainly been popped up and quoted and reposted and tweeted a lot of places, and I've gotten, and this is always a good sign, I've gotten a huge number of very hostile comments.
I love those.
You know, posted on the web that usually begin by saying, this person is an idiot, everyone knows the Constitution, blah. And then they state some proposition that has no actual relation to the text, or what's very common, and this is something that the far right uses a lot, particularly in relation to the 14th Amendment, they say, oh, well, everyone knows the 14th Amendment only applies to the Civil War, and it really has no application today. And that argument is made to suggest that the equal protection of the laws is not really an important or viable constitutional norm, and that due process is not required, or that American citizenship, you know, children born in this country aren't really citizens if we don't want them to be, even though the 14th Amendment says it is. They say, oh, well, all of that was really only about it's only about the situation about the Civil War. We don't have to pay attention to that.
Right.
It's a very weird way of reading a Constitution, because if the framers had wanted to say, you know, the debts incurred during the late War of Secession shall not be questioned, they certainly had the ability in the votes to say that.
Right.
But they didn't. They said the national debt, the entire thing. It's a very clear provision in my mind.
It's very clear, but the other part that I don't find in it is somehow, and again, I don't know how you extrapolate what's written in the 14th Amendment to include corporations as people.
Well, that's there's a fascinating history to that, because really there was no discussion of that at the time. And there's a case, as I recall, it's called Santa Clara Railroad, that was argued in front of the Supreme Court, you know, at least, I think, about 20 years after the Civil War, in which one of the framers of the 14th Amendment produced from his pocket while he was standing in front of the court, he said, I have here the journal of the Joint Committee of 15 on Reconstruction that wrote the 14th Amendment, and this journal makes clear. Of course, no one else had a copy of it because it had been lost for the two decades before that. This journal makes clear that this is what we intended, and the court accepted that argument. I've actually read that journal quite carefully for my book, Democracy Reborn, which is a history of the framing of the 14th Amendment, and there isn't any such language in there. So it's kind of one of these constitutional myths that's gotten accepted. Now, I do believe that the 14th Amendment provides some due process rights that would apply to corporations as well as people, but it doesn't. There's nothing in it that suggests that corporations and individual human beings are exactly the same thing and have to be treated the same way in all regards. That's one of the sort of constitutional myths that has become accepted by everyone.
Yeah, including the Roberts Court, who has now pretty much declared them as people.
Somebody asked me to predict what would be the top 10 rulings of the Roberts Court by 2020. And I said, well, the top one is going to be that the 14th Amendment incorporates the Bill of Rights for corporations, but not for individuals. And that for your listeners, that's intended to be ironic.
But no, it's not. It's true. You look at
really
the most recent.
On track to something like that.
Yeah, you look at the most recent decisions they've come out. The AT&T case here recently, you know, basically ending class action lawsuits. Again, you know, another one of these. If you're going to screw people, do it in small amounts to a whole bunch of people.
Well, they've used the concept of due process to protect corporations in a number of contexts. Another one that obviously in the free speech context in Citizens United, but also in a whole series of decisions applying the notion of due process to restrict, very sharply restrict, the ability of state legal systems to provide punitive damages against corporations. And that's something that I can't find in the text at all. It's quite a remarkable set of decisions that really have been made pretty much since the year 2000. So it's another example of the way in which the rights of corporations are spreading. And if you read the way the justices talk about corporate speech rights in the Citizens United case, they make clear in their opinions that they think speech by corporations is in some ways more important and more valuable than speech by individuals. Justice Scalia, in his opinion, says corporations are the principal engines of our economy. Justice Kennedy, in his opinion for the court, says corporations have more information about policy than individuals. Their speech is in many ways more important than that of individuals. And I think that's a very kind of odd and ominous trend. You can believe that corporate speech needs to be protected without somehow thinking that it's, you know, because they're more powerful than other people, their speech is more important than that of other people.
And you would think that the far right, the ones who believe that they're the individual and the power of the individual and this whole Horatio Alger vision that most of my right-wing friends have, that would run against everything that they believe.
Well, that would be true if they lived in the year 2011, if they had any capacity to look around and see where actual power resides in our current system.
Point.
But the model they work on is that there's a huge threat to liberty, and it's all government, and that nothing in the private sector can threaten liberty at all. You know, it's as if they live in a world in which people run, you know, individuals run the feed store and the blacksmith shop and the saloon, and that's the private sector, and government is this juggernaut that has huge power over everything else. And it really doesn't describe the world we live in which enormous amounts of economic and political power have been concentrated in these private organizations that are legal fictions.
Yep. All you got to do is look at the Koch brothers and their Americans for Prosperity and Freedom Works and Karl Rove's Front Group and all of that.
Exactly.
Last question I've got for you, you know, moving forward with this hostage situation with the debt ceiling, where do you see this going? Are they going to – will rational minds come to some agreement here soon so that we don't have this drawn-out scare that I think even being drawn out is going to cause problems?
Well, I would say you'd have to bet that they'll come to some kind of settlement. Whether it will be advantageous or not, I don't know, because history suggests that agreeing to cut only a huge amount out of government expenditures instead of all of them in the middle of a depression is a recession is a good way to fall all the way into the depression. And my article was intended to say, gosh, wouldn't it be nice if the administration at least put on the table the prospect that if the Republicans won't agree to a responsible plan for the debt, then the administration will just go ahead and make sure that the debt is paid because it's required to under the Constitution. I don't expect that to happen.
No.
But I do think it would be, you know, one of the reasons that you bring, you know, that you bring your brass knuckles to the fight is not use them, but just so people know you've got them. Mm-hmm. And the Republicans are very proud. They have on their website, you know, the Democrats brought a club to the fight. We brought a flamethrower. They like to believe that they have all the terror weapons. And I would like to see the administration sort of put Section 4 of the 14th Amendment in its pocket just so everyone knows it's there.
Yep, and that's the hope. Garrett Epps, I appreciate the time. Professor, I appreciate it. Great article. Again, it's linked at thericksmithshow.com. Just click on Garrett Epps' names. Thanks so much, brother.
Great to be here.
All righty, we're going to take a quick break. Right back after this, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. This is The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Center of the working class majority. Rick Smith.
Do you need a sign or promotional material for your business, campaign, or function? Then All Union Signs and Promos is the place for you. For years, All Union Signs and Promos has been serving South Central Pennsylvania with affordable, high-quality, union-made and American-made signs and promotional products. We want you to be seen. We set ourselves apart not only by being your one-stop, full-service sign shop, but also being able to tie that image into a full line of promotional products. Our dedicated staff will print, design, and deliver your most effective advertising tool on time and on budget. If you have a message, we have a sign. When you need your name on it, All Union Signs and Promos will do it with a memorable and unique union-made and American-made product. For more information about union-made and American-made products, visit our website at allunionsigns.com. That's allunionsigns.com. Or give us a call at 717-221-8888.
At PSECU, we know those holiday bills can really pile up and hit you with double-digit interest rates or fees that start to snowball. Next thing you know, you're buried in a mountain of debt. Dig out by using our 3.9 annual percentage rate Visa balance transfer. Good through December 31st, 2012. That's a really big deal. And you heard that right. Our Rebate Deal 3.9% APR is good through December 31st, 2012, and we don't charge you a balance transfer fee. So if you used any other credit card to pay for your holiday purchases, move those high-interest rate balances to your PSEC Visa. The sooner you get in on this really big deal, the more you'll save. Financing Lent is what we do best. Talk with us. Call 800-LOAN-555 or go to pscc.com/lent to get in on our really big deal Visa balance transfer. Don't wait. Start saving.
This credit union is federally insured by the National Credit Union Administration. Equal opportunity lender.
Waving the flag of freedom for people, not corporations. Rick Smith.
And welcome to the Rick, back to the Rick Smith Show. Or check out the website at therickSmithShow.com. Interesting story out of the AP. Pennsylvania state lawmakers accepted more than $150,000 in gifts, free food, lodging, and transportation last year, according to the latest set of mandatory reports filed with the State Ethics Commission. State legislators traveled to at least six states and to China, India, Ireland, and Switzerland. That's an interesting way of getting there. For free, they watched NHL games. Two were members of the Erie Yacht Club, and one took $2,750 worth of ski lift passes. A whole bunch of stuff being handed out. I love some of the, I love some of the little things that they ended up getting. Stuart Greenleaf, Montgomery County, listed $12,136 worth of construction services from a retired home builder who helped him construct a new home after it was destroyed in a fire. I thought that's what the insurance was supposed to be. And you go through these lists of all the folks who've been taking things. Most of them are Republicans. And I'm going, really? Haven't you figured this out? I mean, there were some Democrats. Dwight Evans, the Democrat from Philly, took $670 in Philly, or in Eagles tickets and transportation. But down the list, you look at some of these, Johnny Pippi, Republican from Allegheny, spent more than a week in China and India last summer. The cost was more than $19,000, and it was picked up by the Aspen Institute. Some DC think tank. You look at this stuff and you go, really? He also went to the Legislative Leadership Institute Academy of Foreign Affairs in Green Bay, Wisconsin, and spent well over $12,000. You go, man, where's this stuff coming from? Our governor got a $530 glass etched crystal something or other from the Pittsburgh Penguins, thanking him for the new arena. He had nothing to do with the new arena. Republican Warren Kampf from Chester County received a $700 donation in the way of a chartered bus. So this company gives him a chartered bus for him and his family to come to the Capitol for the swearing in. I'm sorry. I'm not happy with that kind of stuff. These guys are well paid enough. He can drive himself. Besides, it's paid for mileage. But just this is the kind of stuff that drives everybody nuts. This is bipartisan nuts. And this is where I've always said you should get nothing from corporations. You should sit on no boards. You should be a legislator. And you should work very hard at not appearing to pander to any one particular group. You should do your job. Anyway, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk with Paul Segunda. I'm going to talk a little bit about the Boeing decision. Right back after this.
Uncovering the con in conservatism.
Rick Smith.
The Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham. Massachusetts AFL-CIO President Robert Haynes says labor will fight a bill passed by the Democrats in the state house there that curbs health care collective bargaining rights for municipal public workers, including police and teachers. Haynes says labor and Democratic Massachusetts Governor Deval Patrick agree on the principles necessary for municipal health care reform in Massachusetts, and they agree that labor will maintain a meaningful role. In a printed statement, Haynes says that Governor Patrick is an outspoken and clear supporter of unions and collective bargaining. Haynes notes that the governor credits his mother's union job for keeping their family out of poverty as he grew up in Chicago. The Massachusetts AFL-CIO says with a governor and a state senate both consistently on record in favor of municipal health care relief and collective bargaining, labor is confident that when legislation ultimately passes, collective bargaining will remain strong. Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker was against combined reporting before he was for it. Jesse Russell reports.
Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker has been faced with a reality check concerning one of his primary campaign platforms. Walker said multiple times on the campaign trail that he wanted to end combined reporting, but a Department of Revenue estimate says doing so could cost Wisconsin nearly $346 million in tax revenue. The law was enacted by former Governor Jim Doyle in 2009 and requires companies and any of their subsidiaries doing business with the state to file taxes as a single entity. Walker alleged during his campaign that the law was costing major corporations millions of dollars. Walker had this to say during his response to Doyle's 2010 State of the State address.
Governor Doyle and the Democrat-controlled legislature should start by repealing the job-killing combined reporting tax so that Wisconsin can keep good-paying jobs here.
Instead of repealing the law, Walker, after meeting with businesses, is proposing changes. One such change would prohibit the Department of Revenue from challenging the way companies report taxes on subsidiaries. 23 states currently have combined reporting laws. In Wisconsin, the idea was originally proposed by former Republican Governor Tommy Thompson as a way to battle tax evasion.
The United Steelworkers are presenting shareholder resolutions calling on oil companies to improve disclosures on oil refinery safety. The resolutions call on the boards of Marathon, Valero, and ConocoPhillips to fully disclose their oversight of process safety management, staffing levels, and inspection and maintenance of refineries and other equipment. The union hopes greater transparency will lead to safety improvements that will save lives in the oil industry. This newscast made possible in part by the American Federation of Teachers, a union of professionals, and by the National Association of Letter Carriers. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.com.
Saving work in America, one show at a time. The Rick Smith Show.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Remember, check out the website at thericksmithshow.com. You remember last night we were talking about Nikki Haley, the governor of South Carolina, and her, again, you know, I'm amazed that the Republicans feel this emboldened, this brazen to come out, a sitting governor coming out and saying she is going to fight with everything that she can to make sure that the workers at the Boeing facility in South Carolina cannot unionize. I mean, I'm struck by the brazenness, by this vibrato that where they think the American people are with them on this, which is why I got to be honest that the Supreme Court or the NLRB decision, I think was absolutely the right one. But the radical right wing has just gone nuts over this. Their heads are about ready to explode. Here to talk a little bit about the decision is Paul Segunda. He's an associate professor of law at Marquette University. Paul, thanks for taking time for me.
It's my pleasure, always.
You know, walk me through this Boeing decision. The way I see it is the company came out and they said right from the beginning, this is a retaliation for you having gone on strike three times.
You know, it's very interesting. There was a letter that was sent to Acting General Counsel of the NLRB, Leif Solomon, today, by Michael Luttig, who's the general counsel for Boeing, saying, this is new work. We have never had this work before, so we're just starting new work in South Carolina. And that's just against everything else that has been, thought to have occurred before this time. That is that this is work that existed in Seattle. This is an attempt to relocate that work to South Carolina in retaliation, as you said, for previous strikes that the union workers had engaged in, protected activity. The law under the National Labor Relations Act is pretty clear that if you take response as an employer in retaliation for employees using their protected rights under the National Labor Relations Act, that's going to be considered discriminatory and unlawful. And I think that's all that Acting General Counsel Solomon's doing right here.
You know, I look at this, and I guess the big question, there are a couple of things that pop into my mind. One is this shows to me, again, why we need labor law reform. But two, it brings up the question, do you have the right to strike in this country? I mean, strikes have been few and far between. We haven't seen as many as we've seen in the past. But do you really have that right?
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly in the law. Section 13 of the National Labor Relations Act says that workers have the right to strike. But, of course, going way back, to the time when the Supreme Court of the United States said that workers could be permanently replaced, that has taken away a lot of the meaningful ability to strike because you could be permanently replaced. It could be a long time before you get your job back. One of the things that has legislatively been attempted by the labor movement is the so-called getting rid of the replacement worker right. And unfortunately, it came up as recently as 1993, but there really hasn't been any success in trying to get that ability of employers to permanently replace employees taken away, and that's been a real hindrance on the right to strike.
No, I mean, that was the only reason I voted for Bill Clinton, to be honest with you. And it was Bob Dole who was the one who filibustered it.
That's correct.
If my memory serves right. And again, I go back to this whole fight over the Employee Free Choice Act, which I think would be a step in the right direction. Personally, I would rather have the strike replacement bill and have to stand there and slug it out.
You know what? If workers have the true right to strike, which is the ultimate economic weapon in labor disputes, then we would have a level playing field again between industrial combatants. As it is now, companies like Boeing can take these types of retaliatory action, and there's very little that can be done, as being shown right now with all, as you put it, the bravado from the governor of South Carolina and now the general counsel of Boeing.
You know, because in looking at the right to strike, I mean, I say often the only thing that workers have is their ability to say, I'm not going to work. The employer controls everything else. The conditions, the times, the wages, everything else is controlled. So you don't have a level playing field, as you've said, unless you have that ability and that security to say, I'm going to withhold my labor for a little bit more.
And you know what? This has been the issue here in Wisconsin, too, with the public sector situation. You know, we've gone through a litigation phase now with the open meetings law, but eventually, if the workers here are going to fight back against Governor Walker, the ultimate weapon that they have is to withhold their labor. There is no law, obviously, that requires you to work. That, of course, would be in violation of the 13th Amendment, which prohibits involuntary servitude. So, you know, that's the ultimate right and power that labor has and always will have.
You know, and we were in Wisconsin. We were there during the height of the people coming out into the streets. Mm-hmm. I remember the one labor council there had come out and said they issued a general strike authorization, that they were going to, at some point, if need be, call for a general strike and shut everything down. And I think it's that kind of power, it's that kind of unity that's going to have to happen to change the tide. Because, you know, in looking at this, going through this Boeing decision, let's say the NLRB does decide on the side of the workers. This goes into the court system, and we have a very conservative court. It just gets thrown out.
It goes up to the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals, which is in charge of South Carolina. In fact, you want to hear something ironic. The current counsel for Boeing himself used to be a D.C. Circuit judge who was put on that court to potentially go to the United States Supreme Court. I think he got a little restless and decided to cash in and go to Boeing to become a general counsel. So, you know, when you're talking about these types of corporations, when you're talking about conservative jurists, it's very difficult, I think, for labor to get a fair shake in this type of environment.
So let me ask you this, Paul Secunda. You know, all I hear from the radical right is that the NLRB, they're just being union thugs. They're pushing their weight around. They're beating up on this poor company, and this poor company should have the right to do whatever they want. This decision, in my opinion, is in my reading of what the NLRB is supposed to be doing.
Correct. It's not controversial at all. The Republicans and the right wing believe the louder you speak, the more likely people are to believe you. But if you look at the labor law, if you look at it in a thoughtful and deliberate way, it's very clear under Section 883 of the National Labor Relations Act, which deals with unlawful discrimination, that employers are not permitted to take retaliatory action against workers engaged in protected activity. That's all that's going on here. There has been previous strikes in the Boeing facility in Washington. And to avoid similar strikes, they're moving to a right-to-work state in South Carolina. That type of runaway shop is a class type of situation. The law is extremely clear. And hopefully, you know, when the facts come out, the National Labor Relations Board will be successful in prosecuting this case.
Yeah, but the problem is there just doesn't seem to be any teeth, in my opinion, in that. They may be successful, but at the end of the road, Boeing's going to get what they want because they're a big multinational corporation, and the workers, well, they're disposable. And what I think most people need to understand, and the point that I think is most important in this, is it's the union. It's the workers through their union who are able to even get this far. If those Boeing employees in Washington didn't have a union, we wouldn't hear a peep of this, and that work would be in South Carolina without anyone even knowing it.
Yeah, the collective voice is essential. Without a collective independent voice, workers are powerless.
So, you know, where does this go from here now? It's going to go to the full board, am I correct?
Well, it's a pretty, you know, the way that works is the board allows itself to have all five members of the board hear the most important cases. And given the notoriety and the amount of attention this case is getting, I would suspect that eventually, you know, the first thing that happens is it gets heard by an administrative law judge. The administrative law judge does a fact-finding and makes a decision about whether there's an unfair labor practice. Once the ALJ decision's in, then it would likely go up to the five-member board in Washington, D.C. to weigh in. Of course, there's three Democrats and two Republicans right now on that board as far as who appointed them. So we might end up with a winning NLRB decision, but as you point out, it then would be appealed by Boeing to the Fourth Circuit. And given the makeup of the Fourth Circuit and their politics, all bets are off at that point.
Let's say miraculously, the Fourth Circuit says, you know what, NLRB, you guys are right. We're going to say this is an unfair labor practice. We're going to side with the workers. What happens? What happens from that point?
Well, that's the tough thing to say because a lot of people criticize the National Labor Relations Act as being toothless. That is, that there aren't really very good remedies. I mean, you would like to see Boeing forced to give this work to the workers who are unionized in Washington. I'm just not sure that that's exactly what's going to happen. They might just say, you know, in the future, to the extent that you have additional work, you should give it to the unionized workers, but we're still going to allow this one to go to South Carolina.
Basically a slap on the wrist and, oh, promise, don't do it again.
It's a possibility. I know Acting General Counsel Leif Salomon would like to see that exact work, the 787 work, sent back to Washington. But, you know, I've seen too many labor law cases where the remedy has just been inadequate.
And again, I go back to my initial call. This is exactly the reason we need major, major labor law reform in this country.
I completely agree.
Paul Secunda, I appreciate your time. Always great talking to you. Look forward to having you get back again real soon.
I look forward to it as well. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Paul Secunda, Associate Professor of Law at Marquette University. We're going to take a quick break right back after this with your calls. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. This is The Rick Smith Show. Yeah.
Republican congressional leaders don't seem to be equipped to balance the river. You can take the blood on the NPR and dozens of other popular effective programs have been scampered to save one of the least popular, least effective federal programs on the books, the annual taxpayer subsidy for big oil. Gasoline prices were rising $4 a gallon or higher. The House GOP voted unanimously to let the oil giants continue siphoning $4 billion a year from higher government bills.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Remember, check out the website at therickSmithShow.com. You know, kind of interesting having the discussion with Paul Segunda. One of those things when you're looking at the law as it's written. Again, you know, it does absolutely say workers have the right to strike. But again, I think what's happened too often is that we've become so lax in that enforcement that it just becomes second nature for us to accept it. When a company moves out of town, because, well, you know, they didn't take the $8 an hour pay cut that we're offering, so we're going to move down south to where we can get that $8 pay cut plus a whole bunch more. We've just become so used to it.
Well, and for a while you had a very inept and politically dominated NLRB, which unions for a while totally avoided. So there were reasons for, you know, apprehension on the part of unions to even fight for some of this stuff. But one thing the Obama administration did, they absolutely strengthened the NLRB. Thank God they did.
Well, it couldn't have been any worse than the Bush years.
Oh, it was horrible.
Oh, I mean, just absolutely
many
horrible.
Unions, like I said, just didn't even use the NLRB. It was just, to them, it was a waste of time.
I'll tell you, though, it's scary stuff. Scary, scary stuff. Anyway, the Republicans today passed, but again, another one of these bills. Again, where the party of the paycheck? Where'd they go? Where are the people who said we're going to create jobs? We're going to be the party of the, where did they go? Because all I see are divisive issues. All I see are things to divide us. And today they passed another one of their anti-abortion bills that basically redefines what rape is. And it creates something called rape audits. I kind of just not getting this whole obsession. And that's really what it is. It's this obsession that they have with women's rights. That's kind of confusing to me. I mean, I go back to this guy, in South Dakota, the guy who said, you know, I can understand abortions. If you under these conditions, evidently not. Is that up?
What?
To play a clip.
A real life description to me would be a rape victim, brutally raped, savaged. The girl was a virgin. She was religious. She planned on saving her virginity until she was married. She was brutalized and raped, sodomized, as bad as you can possibly make it, and is impregnated. I mean, that girl could be so messed up physically and psychologically that carrying that child could very well threaten her life.
Well, this guy would be all for that. Evidently, Chris Smith, the Republican from New Jersey, he wants to redefine what forcible rape is. He wants to define rape to where it's forcible. In the very, very small number of rape cases that happen, only in this narrowly defined way can someone possibly get an abortion where federal funds might possibly, conceivably be used. Again, Republicans have pushed that through. Again, on a pretty much a party line vote, you had 16 anti-choice Democrats who joined every Republican. So, again, you know, the family values people. Yeah, it just frustrates me. Where are the jobs? Where are the jobs? You know, I look at this story from the Independent in the UK, and this is one of these moments as a father that I have to be honest, I would not handle well. There was a teenage girl who was a cheerleader, And evidently, you know, according to her and according to the prosecutor and the court system, this kid that went to her high school raped her. He pled guilty to a misdemeanor assault and was back in school. Now, she's a cheerleader. He's on the basketball team. They're cheering. The entire place is cheering for this rapist. She is not. The school takes her out. The principal takes her out of the thing, tells her that if she's not going to cheer for him, she's off the team. I'm really dumbfounded. So she takes it to court. The court in Texas, evidently where basketball and sports are king, rules against her. In fact, rules that her family has to pay compensation of $45,000 because she lost a legal challenge. And the U.S. Supreme Court on Monday said they weren't going to even review the case. You want to talk about adding insult to injury? You want to talk about kicking somebody while they're down? If you want something to scream about, if you want to rail on education or on bad decisions, to me, this is the biggest one. And I can't imagine. I can't imagine this, Jake.
I'm a little confused. They didn't bring it to trial?
He pled guilty. He pled guilty. He was convicted of misdemeanor assault. He was convicted of a crime against her.
It sounds like the problem lies with the prosecutor, didn't charge him with a serious enough crime.
The problem here is that you have a court system who's basically saying, the decision basically said that the reason that she was thrown off the team is that she was representing the school and that she had no individual rights because she was a member of the school and she refused to clap and to shout the rapist's name. So again, you go back and you just, really? Is this the direction we're going as a country? I guess in Texas. And that's our Supreme Court as well. Going back to on Monday, we're going to be going to Washington, D.C., and I'm kind of looking forward to this. Our governor is going to be speaking at one of these school choice, one of these voucher rallies hosted by the American Federation for Children. You know, who could be against that? The American Federation for Children. We just love children. We're the American Federation for Children. Who could be against that? Who could be angry at the American Federation of Children? Other than that, they're an attack group who basically hates public education and teachers. So what they're doing is our governor's going down to give a speech along with Scott Walker. Boy, there's company I would love to have. But they're going to be in Washington, and we're going down to protest and to scream and holler and carry on, hand out flyers, because I truly believe that if we allow this voucher system to go forward, this is the beginning of the end of compulsory public education. This is the end of it. And if you think you're going to save money by doing this, you got rocks in your head, because once the private profiteers get into your pocket, they're never getting out. And, you know, you hear people talk about fascism. Welcome to it. Because once they get in that pocket, it's all over. And like I said yesterday, you know, in Detroit, they're trying to convert a bunch of the public schools there into these so-called charter schools, where you're going to have these boards of directors who are, I'm sure, more than happy to collect some private money to stuff in their pockets. They're talking about 45 of these schools in Detroit. They had 18 for-profit corporations show up and say, yep, well, give us the work. Oh, we'll take it. We'll be happy to take it. There's big profit there. And what's interesting to me, the first thing that's going to happen here is you're going to see the wages of the workers drop. You're going to see the benefits drop. The pensions are gone. And you're going to end up, mark my words, you're going to end up with second-class teachers. And then do you want to see the turnover rate that's going to happen? Because, like it or not, teachers are professionals. It takes an awful lot of practice. It takes an awful lot of experience to stand up in front of a classroom and to control 20, 30, 40, 50, 70 kids, whatever, to control that amount of people in a room and to try and educate them. It takes a lot of ability. If you have a constant turnover, you know, if we're going to Walmartize education, let me know. Give me the memo. I'd like to see the memo on this because I think it's a bad idea. But that's where we're going. We're going to have, you know, people who are just a chapter ahead in the book teaching our kids.
Well, I mean, you look at that situation, and most of those costs are going to probably be solid. The only thing that's a variable will be and negotiable in a sense. You're not going to have negotiations between you and your management. But the only thing left up in the air that you can cut, wages and benefits.
And that's what it's about. It's about stealing from the workers and putting it in their pocket. I mean, I don't know how much more I can emphasize that. That's what it's about. It's about taking from those who are making a little bit of money and making them make less.
And what teacher, unless they're coming out of college and they'll take their first job, is going to work for $20,000-$25,000 a year? That's probably what we're talking about.
And they're not going to stick around long. I mean, that's the thing. It takes a couple of years to become a seasoned professional. It takes a couple of years to where you've worked through some problems. It takes a couple of years to where you get a command of the classroom. It's like sitting behind this microphone. You know, anybody can do it for a night. Try doing it five nights a week. Anybody can do it for maybe a week. Try doing it for a year. It takes some time. You got to work into it. This is what I'm talking about the classroom. At the end of the road, you want people up there who have done it, who understand it, who understand the goals, and have a vision of where you want those kids to be in 6 months, in a year. So much goes into this, but what we've got is we've got this mentality of education that is just like factory work, that every child is an empty vessel where we just open their head and place information in. And next, and we're just stamping out little robots, stamping out little regurgitators of information, just stamping them out like any production line. And the reality is every kid learns a little bit different. Every kid has a little bit different need. And when we move to this for-profit system that they're trying to ram down our throats, if your kid's got a special need, if your kid's got a small problem, they're not getting into the voucher school. They're not getting into the private school because we don't need them. We, the private schools, will have the pick of the litter. And those kids will probably do okay. Even though we don't see the numbers. Right now, they've got the pick of the litter. Right now, they can pick and choose any child they want, and yet their test scores are not better than the public schools, which is just amazing to me. But yet, here we go, going down this line. We need to privatize. We need to privatize. We need to give people choice. But there's no choice, and we already know that. So at the end of it, what's this about? It's about stealing. It's about stealing from the taxpayers. It's about stealing from the teachers. It's about stealing those profits away so that they can fund the Neil Bushes of the world. And those of you who don't know Neil Bush, Neil, the brother of the former president, started a nice little company, Ignite. And their job is to sell proprietary testing equipment. They sell the 2 plus 2 math test. Evidently now 2 plus 2 is trademarked. And if you use that test, you've got to pay Mr. Bush. And where did Mr. Bush get his money? Well, from the Indians, the Saudis, and the Russians. If you think this is just about Pennsylvania or it's just about any state, you need to wake up. This is big investor class money here. They see the potential of profit. They see it because they're doing it already in higher education. They're already screwing college kids. They're already screwing the working class people of this country by pushing this higher education, this online, hey, you can get a master's degree in 14 hours. All you have to do is give us $27,000. Oh, hey, by the way, you can get federal funding for it. And, of course, that federal funding, we now know people are defaulting on it at an amazingly high rate. And their graduation rates are pathetic. But they're handing out paper. The good old diploma mills are now online. Anyway, let's take a quick break. We're right back after this.
Not right wing, just right. The Rick Smith Show.
Or dryer on the fritz, and you don't have the bucks for a new one?
Call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
You say that old refrigerator isn't refrigerating so well.
Call Mike at Klein's, 243-3211.
How about a bunch of money to replace your old stove or microwave?
Again, save the cost of a new one. Just call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
Here at the radio station, we call Mike our resident mechanical and electronics genius. Have you ever met someone who can literally fix anything? That's Mike.
Call them at 243-3211.
You'd be amazed to learn how well many of the older appliances were made. A simple repair might give you another 5, 10, or even 20 years of service from that old washer, dryer, stove, or refrigerator at a fraction of the cost of a new one. Mike repairs TVs and electronics, too.
So call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
Let Mike fix it right, and you pocket the savings.
That's 243-3211 for Mike at Klein's Appliances Repair
Service. Chances are, when you took a shower this morning, an AFSCME member made sure that water was clean. When you drove to work, an AFSCME member maintained the road. When you rode an elevator, an AFSCME member inspected it. I'm David Filman, Executive Director of AFSCME Council 13, the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. AFSCME members enforce regulations, keep prisoners behind bars, take care of patients, protect the environment, and more. The work isn't glamorous, the salaries aren't high, but AFSCME members serve the public in every aspect of our daily lives. Chances are, you'll never see that AFSCME member working in a sewage plant, diving underwater to repair a bridge, or answering a 911 call. But aren't you glad they do? For more information, visit AFSCME13.org. We are AFSCME.
The most important issues of the day. This is the Rick Smith Show.
Back to the Rick Smith Show. Remember, check out the website at therickSmithShow.com now to find out what's going on in Washington, D.C. I've got Justin Duckham, Talk Radio News Service. Justin, thanks for taking time for us.
Great to be here.
What's going on in the big city this evening?
Well, it has been a pretty interesting day today. President Obama has announced that the White House will not be releasing the photos of Osama bin Laden's corpse. This is a pretty big development since earlier in the day, we had the CIA director going on record saying that the U.S. was going to be releasing them, but now citing concerns over possibly inciting violence in the Arab world, it turns out that these are going to be withheld.
I think it's a good idea. There's the gruesome side of me that wants to see them, that there's the part of me that says, you know what, I think it's unnecessary.
And that is certainly what they've been saying. They've been saying that this is something that could incite violence. This could be like the Abu Ghraib pictures, which didn't help our reputation much in that region of the world by any stretch of the imagination. And, there's just been a feeling that this could produce an unstable element and something that has been handled pretty well so far. However, there has been some who've been saying otherwise. There are plenty of Republican lawmakers who are saying that 9/11 families need closure and should be able to see it. And others who are saying that, there are those who gave their lives in Afghanistan, quite a bit of them, and this could be something that could help soothe the pain of their families. So yeah. There's arguments being made on both sides.
Yeah, but my problem with this is once you give them another recruiting tool, and I don't think we need another recruiting tool, the fact that the stories that I'm seeing coming out, he was unarmed, all these stories that are now popping up, I don't think that stuff does us any good.
And that is certainly the argument going out there right now.
Yeah. What else is going on?
Well, beyond that, killing bin Laden did not kill the nation's other problems that are coming up. Negotiations are going to begin tomorrow on raising the debt limit. Republicans, of course, are trying to get several of their demands in before the limit is agreed to, such as making sure that spending does not exceed 20% of the GDP or whatnot. So this is going to be going down tomorrow at the Blair House across the street from the White House. It's going to be led by Joe Biden, representing the White House and the Democrats, and Eric Cantor and John Kyle, the Senate Minority Whip, or Senate Minority Whip, representing the Republicans. So they have until August, according to Secretary Geithner, to hammer out a deal. He says that until then, he can stave off the economic consequences of it through some weird, you know, treasury voodoo.
Right.
But the deadline is coming up.
Some Arthur Anderson type accounting, sure. You know, but here's the thing that bothers me with all this. You know, I look at the Republicans who put up this big stink. When you look at the debt, most of it is most of it happened under Republican rule. But my problem with it is they're going in there saying we want our pound of flesh. You're gonna have to secede to some of our demands. And I got to be honest, I'm not comfortable with that, not at all.
I mean, it's coming off in some people have been describing it more as a ransom than a bargaining chip.
I've been saying it's a hostage situation.
Exactly, and this is something that has some serious ramifications for the country. If they pull the plug on this, they are essentially pulling the plug, not just on economic recovery, but, you know, the country's economic stability and the country's, you know, stance in the world in general.
Are there some general consensus over what the consequences are going to be, what the repercussions of not raising this will be?
Well, the administration has continued to argue that it's going to be disastrous if it doesn't go through. As I mentioned earlier, this is going to be us defaulting on a lot of the loans that we owe, and that is certainly going to harm American prestige going forward in the future.
Yeah, tomorrow's going to be a big day. I'm expecting the president to be in Manhattan. What are you hearing on that?
The president is going to be going to Ground Zero. Interestingly enough, extended an invitation to President George W. Bush, you know, the last guy, but he is not going to be coming. His spokesperson has said that he is going to try to continue to remain out of the public eye and out of the spotlight. And the White House also said today that he is going to be, or that Obama, rather, is going to be laying a wreath, meeting with 9/11 families in private, but will not be giving a speech.
Interesting. You know, the only reason I can think Bush would not show up is maybe like Bin Laden, he can't find Manhattan.
That's good.
Could be. Justin Duckham, Talk Radio News Service. I appreciate your time, brother.
Great to be here.
All righty. And now to find out what we've got going on across town. What do you got for us tonight, Jake?
Yeah, an interesting story again involving Marcellus Shale. It seems that Chevron Corporation agreed to purchase about 228,000 acres in the Marcellus Shale from Chief Oil and Gas and Tug Hill Incorporated. The companies both released a statement on Wednesday. Terms of the deal were not disclosed. The acreage is primarily located in southwestern Pennsylvania. The transaction will give San Ramo, California-based Chevron an additional 5 trillion. Let me repeat that. 5 trillion cubic feet of natural gas reserves in a Marcellus Shale leasehold. The expansion of our shale gas portfolio gives us additional high-quality resources with strong growth potential as well as proximity to and synergy with existing operations, according to Larry Luquette, who's president of Chevron North America Exploration and Production Company. Chevron bought natural gas producer Atlas Energy Incorporated, which marked the company's first foray into the rich gas fields in parts of the eastern U.S. Atlas is a big player in the Marcellus Shale in western Pennsylvania and elsewhere. Chevron shares were down about 1.7% to about $107.35 in early trading in the New York Stock Exchange. Dallas-based Chef and Tug Hill, a Dallas-based investment firm, will be left with about 125,000 acres in the Marcellus, primarily in Bradford, Susquehanna, Tioga, Sullivan, and Wyoming counties in northern Pennsylvania. So it seems like the rich are, in fact, in Marcellus Shale, Rick, the rich are going to become even richer. Gee, big surprise.
Yay!
Three cheers. Something a little more somber, an article in the Harrisburg Patriot concerning Osama bin Laden. He was unarmed when Navy SEALs stormed his room, according to the White House. Osama bin Laden was unarmed when the Navy SEALs burst into his room and shot him to death, according to the White House spokesman. On Tuesday, a change in the official account that raised questions about whether the U.S. ever planned to capture the terrorist leader alive. The Obama administration was still debating whether to release gruesome images of bin Laden's corpse, balancing efforts to demonstrate to the world that he was dead against the risk that the images would provoke further anti-U.S. sentiment. But CIA Director Leon Panetta said a photograph would be released. I don't think there's any question that ultimately a photograph would be presented to the public, according to Panetta in an interview with NBC News Nightly News. Asked again later by the Associated Press, he said, I think it will. Asked about the final confrontation with bin Laden, Panetta said, I don't think he had a lot of time to say anything. The CIA chief told PBS NewsHour it was a firefight going on up around that compound. I think this was still a split-second action on the part of the SEALs. And I understand later, there was a later press release to say that, in fact, they had considered it and they wouldn't issue a picture of him. So either way, they're going to be criticized. Again, there's some Republicans that are saying there's no reason not to release a photo. I tend to disagree. I think we ought to just leave it the way it is and leave things simmer down. I don't see any reason why we needlessly want to put American lives at risk.
Well, what they want is to be able to rub people's noses in it. You know, that's what they want to be able to do. And
that accomplishes nothing.
Let's move on.
Exactly.
That's, to me, the end of this. And I think the story that you just read is another one of those stories that come out that I don't think are helpful to our cause. I think, you know, look, at the end of this, I just think it's done. Let's move forward.
And the truth is the president gave an order, and the order was, you know, catch him dead or alive. And things happened. This is an ugly business. They accomplished their goal, and you're exactly right. And Lindsey Graham, I mean, come on. Other than just pandering to the right, what did it accomplish? And he above all others, he showed a little common sense, and he has a little experience in foreign policy. He should know that putting that picture out is going to do nothing but inflame rhetoric in the Arab world and accomplish nothing and might kill some innocent American civilians.
But they can thump their chest. We love that.
That's what it is. It's pandering to the right wing crazies.
So tomorrow the president's going to be in New York at Ground Zero to mark the death of bin Laden. The White House says that the president plans to visit with the families of those killed nearly 10 years ago to give them a little bit of closure. There's part of me, and look, I believe the president is a class act. I don't think he's going to use this as a campaign anything. I think he's going to go. He's going to pay his respects. He's going to act like a very class act, which is why I do think he reached out to Bush, and Bush slapped his hand away. And what I find amazing is you've got the people who are Bush's big supporters and the people who are trying to rewrite history saying that they're upset that the White House isn't doing more to share the glory. You know, Bush should get some of the glory. I think by reaching out and saying, hey, you know, come and commemorate this and be part of this. I think that was a class act.
And yet, remember, I believe it was 2003 when they asked him about bin Laden. He said, "Well, I don't think about him all that much. I don't think about him a lot." I mean,
how was that?
I don't think about him a lot when he was asked the question was asked about bin Laden and where he was. Do you think about it? And he said, "Well, I actually don't think about him very much." And that's exactly how George Bush was.
Uh-huh.
That was his personality.
Uh-huh.
So now why should Obama have to share any of the glory? Oh, I forgot. It was that...
I don't know where he is. No, yeah. You know, I just don't spend that much time on him, I'll be honest with you.
There you go.
Yeah, just don't spend that much time on him.
Must have been that magic conversation they had before the transition of power, you know, all that the words of wisdom.
Yeah, the big hug in the words of wisdom.
There you go. Magically transferred all the wisdom that that the little shrub had.
There you go. So is that everything?
That's it, Rick.
All righty. Let's take a quick break. We're right back after this to wrap things up.
In an ocean of red, Rick Smith.
Do you need a sign or promotional material for your business, campaign, or function? Then All Union Signs and Promos is the place for you. For years, All Union Signs and Promos has been serving South Central Pennsylvania with affordable, high-quality, union-made and American-made signs and promotional products. We want you to be seen. We set ourselves apart not only by being your one-stop, full-service sign shop, but also being able to tie that image into a full line of promotional products. Our dedicated staff will print, design, and deliver your most effective advertising tool on time and on budget. If you have a message, we have a sign. When you need your name on it, All Union Signs and Promos will do it with a memorable and unique union-made and American-made product. For more information about union-made and American-made products, visit our website at allunionsigns.com. That's allunionsigns.com. Or give us a call at 717-221-8888.
My name is Joanna, and my job is to protect children, to help them live in safe and stable families. I work for you, the taxpayers in Children and Youth Services. Every day, I help children and families in crisis. Many parents have lost their jobs, making it harder to keep a roof overhead, food on the table, and stress under control. My caseloads are huge, and waiting lists for critical services are too long. Yet I know the safety of these children depends on me. Even in tough economic times, legislators must fund these vital programs. Because if we don't help these kids now, the cost to them and to us will be much higher later on. Children don't only depend on me doing my job, they're counting on you to care about their safety. Contact your state legislators today. Demand that they invest in programs that prevent and treat child abuse. Because a child in pain shouldn't have to wait.
Brought to you by SEIU Local 668. Visit our website at SEIU668.org and join our Human Services campaign.
Organizing America 3 hours each night. The Rick Smith Show.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Remember, check out the website at thericksmithshow.com. If you missed any portion of the program, you can download our podcast right there for your entertainment, your enjoyment. All right there for you. Something happened today 41 years ago, Jake. You know what?
41 years ago.
41 years ago today.
70.
1970.
I should know this.
Yes, you should.
It's something auspicious.
Today was the day, 41 years ago, that four students were killed on the campus of
Kent State. Oh, I do remember that. That was a dark day in the history of this country. I thought it was 5 or 6. It was only 4. Okay.
May 4th, 1970.
Killed by National Guardsmen who were protesting the war, and shame on us for shooting those kids. So, dark, dark day.
A moment to remember and to look back on. And, you know, you look at what happened yesterday. With the rally, and you had, you know, thousands of people coming out and protesting, and you know, the hundreds of thousands in Wisconsin that we saw, and fortunately none of that has happened.
Well, if I remember, Rick, I mean, since you brought it up, I was on the campus, and they were unarmed. They were protesting a war which was, at that time, was becoming increasingly unpopular. It was, from all accounts, it was peaceful. why they were shot to this day, I'm not sure.
Well, here's the thing, and this is how the story that I understand it. You lived through it. I was just a child at the time. But as I understand it, Nixon had announced that they were going into Cambodia to go after the North Vietnamese, and that's when a wave of protests really picked up. And in fact, on the Kent State campus, they torched one of the ROTC buildings days earlier. And this is what, you know, made the governor call out the National Guard to protect the property, of course. And someone got a little trigger happy and bang, 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 and there you go. 4 dead, 11 wounded, and history forevermore.
But on the day it happened, if I remember correctly, no soldier was put in harm's way. It was just somebody who was playing Rambo, and all it takes is one bad move, and if one fires, you know that there's going to be other guardsmen firing, and that's exactly what happened.
And here's the thing. Nobody found guilty. 4 dead, 11 wounded. Nobody found guilty.
I remember seeing pictures of the gas and the dead, and sad, sad period in our history. Those were dark days indeed, when 300 to 500 Americans were coming home dead every week from Vietnam. Sad, sad chapter.
Well, according to a new poll, a new Zogby poll is out that found that only 30% of likely Republican voters, 30% of Republicans, and 21% of those, all voters without a college degree, said that they did not believe President Obama was a U.S. citizen. 16% of all voters believe that the president was born in Kenya. That scares me. And what really scares me is this whole anti-intellectualism that's been going on. I understand questioning authority, but there's a certain point where you go, okay, I've questioned it. Everything that's possible has been put out, and now that's enough.
I saw interviews on national TV, and he brought on some of these Tea Party people, or these birthers, not Tea Party, although they might have been, but they were representing the birthers. And as it was put to them, or they answered the question, well, it appears that it may be. However, you really don't know.
Well, it's like I was saying when I was coming across.
You really can we really trust them? It's leaving that that next stage. You know, the birds are flying to the next stage.
Yeah, I was coming back from Cleveland, and the first thing that you know, the nitwit said, well, they're just going to resign. Yeah, that was going to happen. Anyway, some other news around that I didn't get to tonight. Evidently, the claim is that Dennis Kucinich, if he loses in the primary in Cleveland, he's going to move to Washington State, and he's going to run for Congress there, making him the Congress from this district in Washington State. And surprisingly, as bizarre as it sounds, this scenario has happened in the past. With a Republican named Ed Foreman. He represented a district in Texas for a couple of years. He was defeated in a Democratic landslide of 1964, and then he moved to New Mexico, where he was then elected for Congress. There he lost 2 years later, but still, you know, he was able to pull it off.
Well, is it you know a little bit about him? Is it possible that he'll lose? I would think he'd be fairly popular.
It's very popular. He's going to lose. It's very possible he's going to lose.
Why?
Because they're rigging the district up to where you're going to have two Democrats going head to head, and the other person is very popular as well, as I understand it. And I can't remember her name, but the sentiment is that Dennis has spent a lot of time running on the national stage, and not enough bringing home the bacon. And there's entirely possible a situation where he could lose in the primary.
Reapportionment might get him.
Okay. No, it's going to get him. And they've targeted him. Because you've, like here in Pennsylvania, you've got the Republicans who control everything there. And they control the whole process of redistricting. So they're redistricting his seat out of existence. You know, going to give some of the seat over to the east, where you have La Tourette, who's the Republican, and then some of it off to the west. And I can't remember the name off the top of my head of the woman over there. But again, she's very popular as well. So it'll be interesting. It'll be interesting to see if his national fame and his national power will allow him, because Washington's primary is later in the year. And if the Washington voters would go for it.
Well, I have to say this. I think in the last 2 years he's been the conscience of the party at times. I believe he had enough courage to stand up and say exactly as it would, regardless of the political consequences, and you need more people in government, period, but especially in the Democratic Party. And I think he was one of the few people out there who had the kahunas to stand up and tell it like it was.
Yep. A story from South Korea caught my attention. A religious zealot, evidently on Easter, crucified himself. Yep, the body of a 50-year-old taxi driver was discovered Sunday in an abandoned quarry there in South Korea. According to the Korea Herald, he had nailed himself to a wooden cross. And I'm trying to figure out how you do that. Maybe with his foot, I don't know. But he had drilled holes in his hand. Maybe he drilled the holes and hung his hands up. I don't know. That sounds like it hurts an awful lot. He was wearing his underwear, put on a crown of thorns. He hung there and I can't imagine how miserable and painful that death was. He bled to death. He stabbed himself in the right side, so he had the wound there, and of course drilled holes in his palms. I guess he had been there for quite some time. And what's amazing to me, and what's really scary, is that there are several stories of people doing the exact same thing around the globe. And you know, you know these folks are out there. These extreme folks, and I say let them go. Because they're certainly not happy here.
Didn't they used to do that in the Philippines, if I remember, on a yearly basis?
Yeah, well, good, okay.
You know, they would pick one person, and they would literally...
They'd crucify them.
They'd put nails in their hands and their feet and attach them to a cross.
Good for them. A Reuters story out of Germany caught my attention, because I like these little things. Evidently, the mayor was strolling across the field, and they heard a man screaming. Evidently, he was trapped in a woman's prison after mistaking a shortcut in a nearby park that ended him up in the prison. The 24-year-old man was freed by the mayor.
Police can't make this up.
Police are trying to figure out why the prison gate was open and enabled the man to wander in. And here's the thing. I got to be honest. This is every man's fantasy. And there's probably a line of people now waiting to get in. And I'm sure this next guy would be in the line. His name's Dwayne Starkenberg. Evidently, Mr. Starkenberg has a fetish for young ladies' behinds because on two separate occasions, he ended up in a park on the ground with his face in the buttocks of a fallen lass. He is now on trial.
Anyway. Dare I ask? No. What's the charge?
Indecent liberties. Indecent liberties. So if you grab
the old indecent liberties thing, huh?
So if you grab some young lady's tush, or you do like that guy in the video, the cop in the video with those kids in Arizona who chained themselves to the seat, he had a good handful of her, of her chest, if you will. I mean, a really good handful for a long time. And you could see it on his face and go, oh, hey, that's not too bad. And then he realized, hey, I got my hand on this girl's chest. And he left it there just a bit too long for me. Again, this is a teenage girl he's got to hold a hand of. But, you know, hey, that's just how it is. Anyway, if you missed any portion of the program, you can go to thericksmithshow.com, download our podcast. It's there for your entertainment, your enjoyment. If you want to email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com, I do answer all the emails. I want to thank our guests. I want to thank you for being here. And, of course, the man who makes it all possible, our chief engineer, Brett. Thank you so much. We'll see you tomorrow night.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Together, we can make America better. Email rick@thericksmithshow.com or interact with us anytime at thericksmithshow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
It's coming like the tide of flood beneath the lunar sway. Imperial, mysterious, and amorous array. Democracy is coming to the
It's the Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carla.
Hard in the saddle. Well, it's worth remembering these things, Jethro, because one of the things that plagues our modern society is the fact that we are separated from family, as Scott and Sweden noted. We're separated from community. We're separated from the land. We are cast adrift, and we are little more, I suspect, or seen as little more than breathing fodder for corporate profiteering. Sound fair?
Yeah, we're conditioned through all the media to.